certainly doesn't murder her own mother.
Wasn't an accident.
The new series of This Thing of Darkness on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
I could have died just now.
Starting next Tuesday at 2:15.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on digital radio, this is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday the 28th of January. Good morning, this is Today with Emma Barnett in London and Justin Webb in Cardiff.
The headlines today. Sir Keir Starmer is on his way to China to rebuild relations and trade, despite concerns, serious concerns about whether Beijing can be trusted. We'll follow that. President Trump has said he'll de-escalate a little bit in Minneapolis, where two protesters have been shot dead by federal immigration agents this month.
And also in today's programme,
Labour have won every election. They've won every general election here as well for 100 years. But for the first time now, we have both polling evidence, survey evidence, but also by-election evidence suggesting that Labour might not win. They might not even come second here.
It really is a big deal. I'm in Cardiff, where they are gearing up for the most competitive election that Wales has ever seen, one that might spell real trouble, of course, for Keir Starmer. So we will hear from the politicians, but also from the voters about why they're contemplating change.
People are just fed up. Simple things like dentists. Most dentists in Newport now are going over to become private. 20-mile-an-hour driving on the roads. That was really, really not very well received.
We'll hear live from Labour's First Minister on why her party is still worthy of support. The BBC News is read this morning by Lisa Costello.
Sir Keir Starmer will arrive in China this morning to start the first visit to the country by a British Prime Minister since Theresa May in 2018. Sir Keir, who'll meet President Xi tomorrow, argues previous governments have blown hot and cold in their approach to Beijing and that a consistent relationship is vital. Our political editor Chris Mason is travelling with the Prime Minister.
This trip marks the latest and most important moment in the government's attempt to deepen the UK's relationship with China. The Chancellor, the Deputy Prime Minister and the Business Secretary have all been already. Now it's the Prime Minister's turn. Sir Keir Starmer's argument is China is one of the world's biggest economic players, so a strategic and consistent relationship is in the UK's national interest. And he insists engaging with Beijing allows issues such as human rights abuses to be raised with them. But the Conservatives counter that with the recent approval of a new Chinese mega-embassy in central London, Sir Keir's approach amounts to what they call surrender, when China, as they put it, poses a serious threat to our national security.
President Trump says his administration is going to, in his words, de-escalate a little bit in Minneapolis, where tensions are high following the deaths of two protesters, Renee Good and Alex Preti, at the hands of federal agents. The new head of the Immigration Enforcement Operation, Tom Homan, is replacing the Border Patrol Chief, Greg Bovino. Our correspondent Tom Bateman reports from Minneapolis.
When Donald Trump was asked about the killing of Alex Preti, he said he certainly shouldn't have been carrying a gun. The comments will alarm those calling for an independent investigation into his death. They're also remarkable from a Republican leader strongly allied with gun rights groups, which have already signalled their disapproval about how in this case the administration appears to have bristled against the constitutionally protected right to carry a weapon. Mr. Trump said the death of Mr. Preti was a very unfortunate incident, but he has at the same time veered into commenting on the political views of the two dead Americans or their families, without explaining why this would have any bearing on the issue of their killings at the hands of federal agents. He said of 37-year-old Renee Good, her parents were big Trump fans, but that she had become, in the president's view, radicalised.
One of the world's leading tech bosses has warned that AI share prices are probably a bubble and that there will be carnage if it bursts. Cisco's chief executive, Chuck Robbins, has told the BBC that while some companies won't survive, artificial intelligence will end up bigger than the internet. He said that while AI technology was unstoppable, there may be some financial turbulence ahead.
Every major technology revolution that we see feels like hype to begin with, right? And there's been a lot of discussion about, is this a bubble? And the answer is probably yes. But we had a bubble in 2000 with the internet, and look at where we are today. So the winners emerge, and there's carnage along the way, but it is going to be bigger than the internet.
The government is to offer AI training courses to every adult in the UK. The online courses will teach basic AI skills such as how to use artificial intelligence to create content and assist with admin. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, reports.
Tech giants including Google and Microsoft have designed the AI skills training courses, some of which started rolling out last summer. There are about 600 different courses of varying lengths. Some take several hours, others just 20 minutes. Not all are free. 14 of those which don't cost anything are industry benchmarked. The government aims to reach 10 million workers by 2030, claiming this is the most ambitious training scheme since the Open University was launched more than 50 years ago. But AI tech is evolving rapidly, so these courses could date quite quickly.
The government is launching an 8-week consultation on its plans to make vet prices clearer, to overhaul how veterinary practices are regulated and to clearly set out a complaints process for owners. The Competition and Markets Authority has found that vet prices have risen at nearly twice the rate of inflation. Helene Svinos says she was shocked by the bill she received after an emergency trip to the vet while on holiday.
I had to get a massive loan out, £10,000, in order to make sure I had the money because I didn't want him to go without anything. And my life revolves around my pets, and to have awful treatment and also not be able to complain and then the vet bill on top of that is just appalling. It feels like a real kick in the teeth, actually.
The advertising watchdog has told EasyJet to stop informing passengers that they can pay as little as £5.99 to take large cabin bags on their journeys. The advertising standards agency said the airline couldn't provide proof that luggage could be transported for that price. Our business reporter Ema Moro has the details.
Until recently, EasyJet's website stated that luggage could be stowed in the cabin from £5.99. But when the consumer group Which? Checked more than 500 flights, it couldn't do so for under £23. The advertising watchdog has now ruled that EasyJet's wording was misleading, saying there wasn't enough evidence that the low price was available across a range of routes and dates. EasyJet said the price could be found on different flights, but that the cost depended on multiple factors such as demand and space on board. It didn't provide examples of such sales.
The first woman to be Archbishop of Canterbury will be confirmed in the post at St Paul's Cathedral this morning. The ceremony marks the official start of Dame Sarah Mullally's tenure, succeeding Justin Welby, who resigned after a damning report on safeguarding failures. Dame Sarah said the Anglican Church wanted to be a safe place during times of division and uncertainty.
Lisa, thank you for that. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's get our first look on the programme at the weather with Chris Fawkes, who's at the BBC Weather Centre for us. Morning, Chris.
Hi, good morning, Emma. Well, Storm Chandra may well have cleared off, but it's left a legacy of flooding, of course. The severe flood warnings we had yesterday, which are pretty rare, they have lapsed, but we still have 101 flood warnings in force across parts of England. The vast majority of these are in the south of England. We've got an additional 3 flood warnings for Wales and 8 in Scotland as well. So expect some further transport disruption due to the flooding problems that we still have ongoing. Now, weather-wise today, the remnants of the weather front that has brought all that heavy rain is still actually across the northeast of Scotland. So it's a wet start to the day for parts of Aberdeenshire and for Orkney, with this weather front very slow moving today. Gradually, it's going to be pushing its way northwards, taking the rain into Shetland. Quite windy, actually, for the northeast of Scotland, too, with gusts of around 45 miles an hour today. Across the western side of Scotland, we have some showers working northwards across the Hebrides and the Highlands. They'll tend to clear, and then, actually, it's an improving picture for the majority of mainland Scotland. It will become dry, with spells of sunshine developing widely. Our temperatures today, around 7 to 9 Celsius. For Northern Ireland, some decent weather here. It should be mostly dry with sunny spells, although I couldn't rule out an odd afternoon shower. Again, temperatures around 7 to 9 Celsius. For England and Wales, we've got a cold start to the morning with a risk of a few icy stretches here and there. A few showers today across parts of southwest England and southern parts of Wales, but otherwise it's a mostly dry picture with spells of sunshine pretty widely. And after that cold and locally frosty and icy start to the day, we're looking at temperatures of around 8 to 10 degrees. Those flood warnings gradually should come down in numbers later on today. That's the latest.
Chris, thank you for that. It's 8 minutes past six. Let's have our first look at the papers. Several highlighting Keir Starmer's trip to China. The Mirror going with the headline, The Wu Dynasty, says the Prime Minister is going to be on a charm offensive as he seeks growth-boosting ties with the world's second largest economy. In its analysis, the Daily Telegraph argues he's unlikely to find a pot of gold at the end of the Chinese rainbow. The Sun's editorial says Britain should, of course, have a trade relationship with China, but asks, at what price? And The Guardian says the Prime Minister has insisted the government remains clear-eyed about the national security threat posed by Beijing.
Reeves puts nail in coffin of High Street, declares the Daily Mail on its front page. It says the Chancellor is facing a growing backlash after restricting temporary help on business rates to pubs. The paper says the decision leaves thousands of small shops, restaurants and hotels facing crippling tax rises in April. The Daily Express says the support is small beer for our high streets.
The Times leads with an investigation into how criminal networks sell fake jobs to migrants to help them get work visas. The paper says in meetings with undercover reporters, agents explained how salaries would be paid to make jobs appear real, but that the money had to be transferred back to a different bank account. The Home Office says it's investigating the illegal activity, which it says will not be tolerated.
Several papers react to the government's announcement that leaseholder ground rents will be capped at £250 per year. The Financial Times carries a warning from a group representing 10 of the biggest landlords, which argues that the change would seriously damage investor confidence in the housing market. The Eye says there's every chance the government's changes will make leasehold homes easier to sell and worth more.
Pictures of Keir Starmer wearing a pair of aviator sunglasses during a podcast interview feature widely. Flop gun, says the Daily Star, which explains that he was handed the shades by the host and then quipped, bonjour. The paper calls it a playful swipe at the French President Emmanuel Macron, who had been sporting sunnies because of a bloodshot eye.
It's 11 minutes past six.
There is about to be an earthquake in Wales. Well, perhaps. That's why we're in Cardiff this morning. Gareth Lewis is on the line, the Wales political editor for the BBC. Set the scene for us, Gareth.
Morning, Justin. Look, this is going to be potentially a seismic election. Not my words, the words of a distinguished political analyst in Wales. We've got a new system. The Senate is expanding from 60 to 96 members. It's proportional representation. First past the post is being completely abandoned, and 16 new constituencies, each returning six Senate members. That's interesting. What makes it exciting is this potential for political jeopardy. Labour's been in power for 27 years now in the Senate. It's won every major parliamentary election in Wales for the past 100 years or more, but it is under real threat. Plaid Cymru and Reform, according to the polls, according to what happened actually last autumn in the Caerphilly by-election, are really vying for top spot and really vying to run the Welsh Government after the election in May.
Why? When you look at the polls and you look at the broad figures and you delve a little deeper, what is it that people in Wales are unhappy with? Where is it that they're going politically?
I could be here till 9 o'clock running through all the reasons, Justin, but I'll try and sum it up for you. I think it's partly Labour's own record here in Wales. If you look at things like the NHS and waiting lists, they've had a real struggle to bring them down since the pandemic. Education, Wales has fared pretty badly in the last round of PISA tests. That doesn't go down very well. The 20 miles per hour law, which I know you've already mentioned on the programme already, they spent a lot of political capital, Welsh Labour, pushing that law through, and it's cost them. And then also, if you go back to the resignation of the former First Minister, Vaughan Gething, for accepting a donation from a businessman who'd broken environmental law. Mr. Gething denied that he'd done anything wrong, that it was all by the rules. He nonetheless resigned, and that has left a nasty taste for a lot of voters, potentially. Throw in as well that Plaid Cymru under Rhun ap Iorwerth has emerged as a viable alternative for a lot of left-leaning voters. They're promising to do a little bit more on certain areas than Labour has done. More surgical hubs to try and cut those waiting lists. A different, they would say, better childcare offer and a more pragmatic approach to independence. Rhun ap Iorwerth aware that he might spook some voters, so they're talking about looking at it in detail in a second Plaid Cymru term, not if they end up running the Welsh Government in May. Reform, also doing well in those polls, but Justin, still something of a mystery in Wales. We know all about Nigel Farage. We know about their UK policies. They still don't have a Welsh leader. They still don't have a set of Welsh policies. They still haven't told us who any of their candidates will be in May. Nonetheless, They are pushing around about that 25 to 30%, according to the polls.
Right. We're going to let you go, Gareth. We can't afford to employ you till 9 o'clock anyway. But we will hear from Rhian ap Iorwerth, who you mentioned, and also from Eleanor Morgan, the First Minister of Wales, the Labour leader in Wales, before the end of the programme. But Gareth Lewis, a fine start. Thank you.
Justin, you'll be speaking Welsh by the end, or maybe you already do. I don't know. It's 14 minutes past six. President Donald Trump said on Tuesday he would de-escalate a little bit in Minneapolis. But what does that mean, I suppose, today, amid a backlash over the killings of two people by federal immigration agents? Peter Bowes, our North America correspondent, brings us right up to speed, explaining what President Trump means.
His message seems to be that his broad immigration policies will continue. He believes that they're working, including in Minnesota, which he says has good crime numbers because they took thousands of hardened criminals out of the state. But there's also a tacit acknowledgement, I think, from the president that things went too far. He said of Gregory Bovino, the controversial Border Patrol commander, that he was a pretty out there kind of guy. In some cases, the president said that's good. Maybe it wasn't good here. Now, this is the man who inflamed tensions when he claimed, without evidence, that Alex Preti, the protester who was shot and killed by federal agents, that he had been intending to massacre those agents. So now Mr. Trump has installed his border czar, Tom Homan, to take over in Minnesota. The president says he doesn't think this is a pullback, just a little bit of a change.
In terms of the, you know, he's talked about now there'll be a de-escalation, but that doesn't mean the people there will respond in kind. I mean, you know, it's extremely cold temperatures and people are taking to the streets to protest. There is huge unrest and unhappiness, isn't there?
There is, and we're just seeing that in the last few hours. There are still a lot of people on the streets. There's a tremendous amount of anger, and many of those protesters are insisting that they will continue until those federal immigration enforcement agents have left the state. And from what the president has been saying, there doesn't seem to be any sign of that. Yes, he may change his tactics. I think there could be political reasons for that as well. The Republicans are putting a lot of pressure on the administration. A couple in particular, that Senator Tom Tillis has accused the Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, of being amateurish over her management of the situation, says that she should be out of a job. Lisa Murkowski, the Alaska senator, saying very similar things, that she needs to be accountable for the chaos that she's caused. And in the House of Representatives, Democrats, their leader, has said that she should be fired. And if she is not fired by President Trump, that they will start impeachment proceedings.
Peter Bowes, our North America correspondent, thank you.
And that brings us to 17 minutes past six. And to the news that the chief executive of the UK's biggest investor says the UK has been oversold. The country talks itself down too much. Will has more on that than the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Justin. Morning, Emma. Yes, when it comes to investment in the UK, could argue not many more influential than Antonio Simoash, the boss of Legal & General. He runs the UK's largest pensions provider, managing more than £1 trillion in assets for over 12 million customers. We've been speaking to him for the latest episode of our Big Boss Interview podcast series on BBC Sounds Now, of course, and he told us why he thought we needed more confidence, as you say, as a nation, and that he'd welcome a reset of the UK's relationship with the European Union. But before that, we asked him if he felt British savers were putting enough money away for retirement.
Pensions are the sort of silent powerhouse of the UK, and I think we can make much more of the power of pensions. But to your question, we know that 14.6 million, that's 43% of the adult working population in the UK, is not saving enough for retirement. And so although we have this very large savings pot of 3.2 trillion of pensions in the UK, it's not evenly distributed. There's the parts of the population that are simply not saving enough. I've advocated that from the first day that you start working, you should be able to save for your pension. At the moment, the minimum age is 22. But if you start working at 18, you should be able to start saving from your first pound. At the moment, there's also a minimum hurdle. Then there's an interesting group in the population, 45 to 55-year-olds. So if you're, in a way, young enough that you didn't get your final salary pension, you know, the defined mm-hmm. benefit pension. But in a way, you're old enough that you didn't start saving with the auto-enrollment that only came in 2012. There is a cohort where people haven't saved enough. And so it's not too late. The average, we have 5.2 million workplace customers. The average age is 42. And what I would say for those individuals is that every little bit counts. So you need to save every day. So as a nation, we have a big pension powerhouse, as I said, but individually, there is a cost of living crisis and many people that can't think about the long term because they need to think about the cash for the short term. But for the rest of the population, we need to save more. And yes, as the CEO of the largest pension provider in the UK, I would say that, wouldn't I?
Do you think that the levels, the rates of that auto-enrollment need to go up? What is it in the moment? Just glancing down on my notes here. 5%-ish from employees, 4-5% from employees. You know, there are colleagues in the pensions industry who think that should all just go up.
Absolutely. So I've made that point. We had a blueprint for growth. And that overall report, which, by the way, has a 0.7% GDP increase by 2035. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's 220 billion of additional GDP growth. There's six levers, and one of them, several of them, the government is already acting on, but this particular one that I've advocated for is an increase of that percentage, which currently, as you say, is 8% to 12%. So that in between employers and employees, over time, we increase the rate of contribution to pensions, start from 18 years old, but also increase the contribution to 12%. That's what Australia does. You know, if you do it now, you don't need to do it now in 2026. You can do it progressively, but an increase towards that 12% will make a big difference for those 14.6 million people that I talked about
earlier. Break it down for us then. How would that split work in the 12%, first of all, in your mind?
So obviously, I'm a business leader. It's for the government to decide, but we've said that the 3% from employers goes to 6% and the employee contribution goes from 5 to 6.
It's very difficult, isn't it, for business leaders. I speak to them, big and small, particularly those medium-sized ones that come on our programs every morning. Yeah, great idea in theory, but where am I going to find that when I feel like I'm being squeezed mm-hmm. absolutely everywhere?
What we are advocating for is a glide path for that increase. So we're not saying increase it in 26 or 27, we say progressively over time. And I think as a nation, that allows us to think about the future. We've been around for 190 years as a company. This year, we were created in 1836. And I hope that 20, 30, 40 years down the road, people look back and said, in 2026, the Pension Commission advocated for this glide path. And we're now much better off as a nation.
Got written in block capitals on my notebook in front of me here, risk.
Yeah.
That feels like the word in your world at the moment, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's around policy, whether it's around mm-hmm. decisions that you guys yourselves make. Where do you think we sit as a country in terms of our appetite for risk?
As a country, maybe I make a bigger point, which is I think we're lacking confidence, actually. I think there is an element of we talk ourselves down as a country, and therefore that happens with individuals as well. If you think of the different markets around the world, you see individual investors being more confident, and therefore in that risk return, they see both the risk, but they also see the return. And we tend to be, as a society, more risk averse.
It's amazing that, isn't it? Well, I've gone to work in America a lot, and the number of kind of just everyday people who have an interest in what's going on in the stock market will understand what's going on, will want to talk about it. I mean, that is completely different to the culture.
But there are many other countries around the world. I lived in Hong Kong for some time, and you're in with a cab driver and you're saying, oh, yeah, tell me about the dividend.
Yeah.
Is the dividend progressive or not? And they would kind of argue with you and kind of ask you questions. That doesn't happen in the UK.
Why not?
I think we don't have the same investment culture, but I'm a glass half full type of guy. I think we can do that, right? So we have so much power in the savings that we already have as an economy. It's us collectively, and I don't think this is on government, it's on us as well as business leaders to help educate people. And right now, we're taking specific actions. The FCA is helping. We are doing this as firms. So I think there's a potential to change that.
Where else do you think the UK is lacking in confidence? You've got a good kind of perspective.
I moved here in 2000, actually. I was studying in New York, and I came to London. And that was a place to be. People were like, this is, you know, London, the center of the world. I've lived most of my adult life here in the UK. I'm, in a way, I'm more British than Portuguese. But a few years ago, I was working in Spain, and then I came back to lead LNG. And when I came back, people were like, why? Why are you going back to the UK? And so just over two decades, the sentiment towards the UK, the confidence, to use your word, in terms of the UK, has really deteriorated. And I...
Is that Brexit?
Look, I think the UK has been oversold. I think the reality today is much more positive than what we give ourselves credit to. I think we talk ourselves down. And I know you know this, but it's worth rehearsing. So we're an open economy with stable institutions, with a reasonably, you know, good foundations. Number two, we have a lot of innovation, talent. I talked about Oxford, but we also work with Cambridge, Edinburgh, Manchester. So we have world-class universities. And finally, okay, the US is a much bigger market. But apart from the US, it's really us, Canada, Australia. There are not many other, Japan. So 3.2 trillion of pensions. That's a huge opportunity. And right now, we have the planning reform to help us build better. We have the pension reform that is helping us deploy more of that capital, as we talked about earlier. So I'm more positive right now. I'm more confident than the consensus. And there's some, yes, growth could be higher, and we have structural problems around growth. But inflation is coming down. We'll see probably two Bank of England rate cuts this year. The FTSE has been at an all-time high throughout last year. So I think there are more reasons to be optimistic about the UK. And I think from a sentiment, I talk to a lot of investors, I think from a sentiment perspective, the UK has been oversold.
The government's talked about a reset with the European Union, though. Sensible, do you think?
I think so, actually. It's good to have allies. It's good to have partners. And I think from an economic, you know, actually, as a CEO of a company, if I think not of the politics but of the economics, it makes sense that the economic bloc, we are part of Europe. And we've seen more of the coalition of the willing of different European countries getting together to get stuff done. And I think the UK needs absolutely to be part of that.
That's the Chief Executive of Legal and General, Antonio Simoes there. Plenty more on the Big Boss podcast, as we say, including about investing around the UK, levelling up, if you like, as well. And also, how is one of the leaders of our biggest companies, he manages to stay off his emails from 5 p.m. on a Friday to 5 p.m. on a Sunday, which also seems quite the challenge. Gervase Williams here in the studio with us this morning as well. Gervase, the Chair of Equities at Premier Miton. Morning.
Good morning.
What did you make of what Antonio Simoes had to say, particularly around pensions?
Well, I very much agree. I mean, the whole point is globalisation has all been about the capital appreciation. Most pension funds have two-thirds, maybe more than that, invested in the US. They desperately need diversification. The UK stock market actually leads the world in being good and growing income. We're already seeing it starting to outperform. Bring our savings home. Bring our savings home so we generate more productivity, more local growth. We don't need to generate more jobs in the US. We need jobs in the UK.
Speaking of the US, President Trump talking about the slide in the US dollar recently, saying he's not bothered by it.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the dollar's been coming down quite a bit, not just last year, but this year as well. And that's now led, actually, to, although the US stock market's hitting new highs, it's actually down in, if you're a UK investor, in sterling terms, it's down. What's been interesting about the UK this year is it isn't so much it's gone up, but actually it's been led by small quoted companies. You know, the AIM market's the outperforming market in the UK, and actually now it's leading the world. I think we've got, you know, a long period of UK outperformance from here.
So, certainly not going to be a small company if it does list. Elon Musk's SpaceX could be the biggest IPO listing of shares on a stock market this year by some distance. $1.5 trillion valuation potentially. Financial Times reporting this morning. There may be a date for that now, the summer.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you look back at what's been happening, I mean, actually, although stock markets have been going up, actually bond valuations have been going down, particularly long-dated bonds, you know, debt of 10 or 20 or 30 years. And so that's going to make it harder and harder for some of these growth companies to value. I think it'll struggle as a valuation they're talking about. I think it'll be a difficult issue to get away if bond markets come down. Well, bond valuations are going down, and it'll suck money away from the stock market back into other fixed income.
And we've got, obviously, that US interest rate decision today that we were talking about as well. Is that the kind of big watch for investors today?
Yes, I mean, really, what Trump wants us to do is actually sort of put the accelerators on and cut interest rates further. I don't think they'd be doing that today. But that's been a real problem, because actually, if you over-accelerate, you get too much inflation. And again, that's one of the reasons the bond valuations have been coming down recently.
Gervase Williams, Chair of Equities at Premier Miton. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Well, thank you. And at 28 minutes past six, we'll go from the business to sport. Mike's just joined us. Morning, Mike.
Morning, Emma. Let's start, shall we, in Melbourne. And a big question, is the 10-time champion Novak Djokovic heading out of the Australian Open in the quarterfinals? Come in, Abigail Johnson. He's got work to do here, hasn't he, Djokovic, against Lorenzo Musetti?
Yeah, he looks in serious trouble on Rod Laver Arena. Down 2-0 to the number 5 seed Musetti, and it's Musetti with the opening hold in the third set. I did wander past court 16 when Djokovic was practicing this afternoon. He looked out of sorts. He's been pretty erratic in this match. He was up at over 30 unforced errors before the end of the second set. He had a time violation called when he was down a break in the opening set, and he did have a medical timeout for his right foot after dropping that second set to Musetti. So a distance still to go, but the Italian looking the fresher and looking in the better form. He came in off a straight sets defeat of Taylor Fritz, his fellow top 10 player.
All right, so Djokovic with work to do. Just briefly elsewhere, Abigail, there will be no career Grand Slam this year for Iga Świątek, the reigning Wimbledon champion, beaten overnight by Elena Rybakina in the quarterfinals.
Yeah, those hopes put to bed by a red-hot Rybakina, who has played 5 matches at this year's Australian Open, has not dropped a set. 7-5, 6-1 for Rybakina, who really is a difficult player when she gets on a strong streak. She won the WTA Finals, which is the year-ending championships for the 8 best players of the season at the end of 2025, and she really is matching up well to the conditions here in Melbourne. So Świątek down 7-5, 6-1 earlier today.
Live coverage from Melbourne, including that Djokovic match, gets underway on BBC Sounds from 7 a.m. this morning. Thanks there to Abigail. Next, from Melbourne to Colombo, where England's cricketers clinched a 2-1 series victory over Sri Lanka yesterday. 2 centuries helped steer them to a 53-run victory. Joe Root scored his 20th ODI 100 with an unbeaten 111, whilst captain Harry Brook finished on 136 not out.
It was enjoyable to be out there and to get us to a total that we could defend and bowl well to like that. It gives us a hell of a lot of confidence going into the T20s and the T20 World Cup. Conditions are going to be fairly similar, I reckon, especially with the T20s in Sri Lanka. So it's something that we can look back on. Obviously, it's a slightly short format, but certain ways to play certain bowlers and the different conditions and surfaces. So we've got something to go off now going forward.
Harry Brook there speaking to in-house ECB media yesterday after that win. So next up is a 3-match T20 series against Sri Lanka. The first of those is Friday afternoon in Palakkelly. Elsewhere in cricket, a little bit of breaking news. The former England spinner Moeen Ali has reversed his decision to retire from domestic cricket and has this morning announced that he's to join Yorkshire to play in the T20 Blast this season.
I did miss playing last year. I didn't play anything last year. I think I played only 3-4 games, and then obviously I went to the GSL and then the CPL, which I had a 2-year deal. Always been, it's when I started my cricket, my journey started in county cricket. So yeah, I do want to play for as long as I can, and I want to contribute and win games, and more importantly, hopefully win the title.
That's Moeen Ali. Finally, football, just to mark your card, there are 18 simultaneous matches in the Champions League this evening as the league phase draws to a close. All 6 English clubs in action. You can hear Paris Saint-Germain against Newcastle and Manchester City against Galatasaray, both on BBC Sounds. It promises to be frenetic, and we shall look ahead to that later in the programme.
Mike, thank you.
Tell us, sweetheart, who was it? Who did this to you?
Arrived late to Ambridge. Did you know that most smart speakers can start the program again? Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart and listen from the beginning.
Here, are you ready? Grandma and Grandpa are waiting for us. We need to leave.
Try it for yourself. Just say, ask BBC Sounds to restart.
The time now. 28 minutes to 7, you are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb, who's in Cardiff this morning, and Emma Barnett in London. And now a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
Sir Keir Starmer is due to arrive in China in a few hours, beginning the first visit by a British Prime Minister since 2018. Sir Keir, who will meet President Xi tomorrow, says a steady and consistent relationship with Beijing is vital after what he describes as years of hot and cold policy by previous governments. Downing Street has faced criticism for approving plans for a new Chinese embassy in London, despite security concerns about its location, with the Conservatives accusing the Prime Minister of appeasing China. President Trump says his administration will de-escalate a little bit in Minneapolis amid a backlash over 2 fatal shootings of protesters by federal immigration agents. In a move aimed at easing tensions, the border czar Tom Homan has arrived in the city to replace the hardline Border Patrol commander Greg Bovino. One of the world's leading technology bosses has said the AI market is probably a bubble and there will be carnage if it bursts. Speaking to the BBC, the chief executive of Cisco, Chuck Robbins, said some companies would not survive the financial turbulence, but that artificial intelligence would be bigger than the internet. The government says it aims to reach 10 million workers with its artificial intelligence training program by 2030. Many of the online courses will be free, teaching basic AI skills such as content creation and how to handle administrative tasks. The Advertising Standards Authority has told EasyJet to stop claiming passengers can pay as little as £5.99 to take large cabin bags on board. The decision follows an investigation by the consumer group which found it cost at least £23 to stow luggage in the cabin on more than 500 flights. The first woman to become the Archbishop of Canterbury will be confirmed in the role at a ceremony at St Paul's Cathedral this morning. Dame Sarah Mullally says she wants her tenure to ensure the Anglican Church is a kind and safe place during times of division and uncertainty.
Thank you for that. It is 25 to 7. Keir Starmer goes to China to kowtow, according to the leader of the opposition. Henry Zeffman is our chief political correspondent. But the government is placing this, isn't it, Henry, in an interesting way. They're suggesting there is a middle road to be found. And I suppose that politically is the important thing for Keir Starmer.
Yeah, I think that's right, Justin. I think Sir Keir Starmer's purpose in this visit, the first trip to China by a British Prime Minister since 2018, and undeniably significant, therefore, is designed to be a pragmatic purpose. He is talking, as he arrives in China in the coming hours, of how China matters for the UK, like it or not. He says it is one of the world's biggest economic players, and therefore the UK must have a strategic and consistent relationship with them. Essentially, he's saying China's economic might means that it is unignorable, and he is certainly not ignoring it on this visit. He is arriving with around 60 British businesses and cultural leaders as part of his delegation. He'll be meeting Xi Jinping in Beijing tomorrow, but as you say, also eliciting pretty intense criticism from the Conservative Party, who believe he should not be going. Kemi Badenoch writing in The Telegraph this morning that this government is behaving towards China as if good intentions are still enough, and then using that word saying that the government is kowtowing to China.
And her concern being that you can do all the trade you like, but if the Chinese have all the power, then in the longer term you might be doing yourself down. But also, of course, the question of Jimmy Lai, this British citizen, who's a joint citizen, isn't he, who is in prison and who the British government says shouldn't be.
Exactly right. Jimmy Lai, there's also human rights concerns, not just raised by the Conservatives, but other critics of this visit, the Chinese government's approach to the Uyghur Muslims, and also China's designs on Taiwan and whether those might come to a head in the coming years. Sir Keir Starmer, I think, would say, indeed will say over the coming days, that his eyes are open to all of those risks, but he is merely following the practice of other leaders. And they are pointing out in Downing Street that since Theresa May went in 2018, the German chancellors have been four times. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, throughout that period, has been three times. Mark Carney, the Canadian prime minister, after quite a long gap, similar to the British one, visited China recently. Now, that elicited quite a lot of criticism from President Trump, which is interesting. But then, of course, President Trump himself is going to China in April as well.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
Well, sticking with that story, as we will throughout the programme, he will be the first Prime Minister in 8 years when he arrives, Sir Keir Starmer, shortly in China to visit, meeting President Xi tomorrow, as you were just hearing. It is a major statement, history in the making even, but is it the right one? Can he carry it off? And how's it being viewed in China? Laura Bicker is our China correspondent, coming to us from Beijing. Good morning, Laura. I'm hoping we've got Laura on the line. Perhaps there's a slight glitch. I think I can hear. But Laura, let me just start by asking, with the hope that you can hear this, what is the expectation on the China side of this trip? We will come back to Laura if we can. That was the attempt to speak to our China correspondent, but we'll be sticking with the story throughout the programme.
Let us turn instead to the new Archbishop of Canterbury, because we have one, finally, Sarah Mullally, to be confirmed today at a service at St Paul's over Christmas. Our guest editor, the former Prime Minister Theresa May, spoke to her. She asked her what her response was to historic sexual abuse within the church and what she'd do to change the culture of the church in her new job.
The Church of England had significant safeguarding failures for which we are truly sorry. Safeguarding is at the heart of the Christian gospel. It's around reaching out to the marginalised, the vulnerable. Being safe is at the heart of what I believe in terms of my Christian faith. We have made progress. We can never be complacent, and it certainly will be something that I will pay primary attention to as I become Archbishop of Canterbury.
Let's turn to Aline McBull, our religion editor, who's outside St Paul's already for the service. And she was talking then about historic sexual abuse within the church because, of course, one of the criticisms of her has been that she herself had not always taken it seriously enough. Has that now been settled as an issue?
Well, it's been settled from the point of view of the church. That was a particular case while she was Bishop of London, where somebody had complained that she had behaved inappropriately in getting in touch with a priest about whom allegations were made, and that in turn contributed to the harassment of the complainant. Now, it was decided by the church that she didn't have a case to answer. The problem for a lot of survivor and victim advocates is that that decision was made by the Archbishop of York. So it was he who decided there was no case for the incoming Archbishop of Canterbury to answer. And that is a lot of what the issues are around safeguarding in the church that critics see, that there isn't the level of independence that there should be. And I think high on her priority list, as I think you heard her say there, will be bringing about a lot of the changes that the church has promised will happen, but have just been very, very slow in the coming.
The wider question, though, is whether the job is possible to do, isn't it?
It's in terms of safeguarding, that's the first issue. There are, for a lot of people, quite easy changes that can be made if the church pushes through what it's already promised. The Charity Commission has got a bit frustrated and issued quite a blunt statement towards the end of last year saying this all needs to happen much more quickly. In terms of holding things together more broadly in the Church of England, I mean, Dame Sarah Mullally has got a very difficult task ahead of her, because we're talking about holding together people of very different theological viewpoints within the Church of England, but then also the wider Anglican Communion as well, with very different cultural landscapes. And she has the added pressure, I suppose, that her predecessors have never had, which is the fact that some, even in the Church of England domestically here at home, but certainly a lot outside in the Anglican Communion, are theologically opposed to her having even been ordained as a woman, as a priest, never mind as a bishop, and now somebody who's leading them. So it's always been a difficult job for the Archbishop of Canterbury to hold things together, to make the kind of changes that are deemed necessary, but extra pressure on Sarah Mullally, Dame Sarah Mullally, because as the 106th Archbishop of Canterbury, she is the first woman.
Aline McBull, outside St Paul's. Thank you.
We can now go back to Laura Bicker, our China correspondent, coming to us from Beijing ahead of the Prime Minister arriving on that visit, the first for a UK Prime Minister in 8 years. Laura, good morning.
Good morning. I'm hoping you can hear me this time.
We can. We can. I was asking about the expectation on the China side of this trip. Put us in the picture in Beijing.
So I think one of the key things for China is the UK really isn't a top trading partner, but they see London as a key financial heartland, one with prestige, one with heritage. So there will be some kind of deal, I think, to be done. China believes the UK is just far too close to the United States. They believe that London simply follows Washington when it comes to making foreign policy. So for them, this will be about trying to kind of bring a key US ally a little bit closer. You'll see them show on state media images of the British Prime Minister touring the Forbidden City, shaking hands with Xi Jinping. So for them, it's It's about showing the world, here we are, shaking hands with the United Kingdom, a close relationship, one that has a close relationship with, the United States. Here he is in Beijing. Here he is doing deals while Donald Trump's continuing to threaten trade tariffs. This is Beijing really playing the long game, using trade to kind of gain influence, gain standing in the world.
And in terms of the play from the Prime Minister, has he got the ability to manoeuvre well, do you think? What you know of China and the power plays and how it all works? Because there's a lot of concern around this trip.
I think, yeah, I can hear the concern coming. It's really interesting for me sitting here in Beijing watching all the debates around what's happening between China and the UK. I think when it comes to blazing a path, we heard about Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister. Now, this was a country, Canada was a country with the worst relationship in the Western world with China. And now they've made a comeback. And when he was here, way before his speech in Davos, Mark Carney held a 40-minute, quite frank press conference, all questions asked. And he said there, this is because there's a new world order and we have to be part of it. So in many ways, Mark Carney has blazed the trail for the others. But I think what I would say is China correspondent and this debate between trade and security and which one and how do you guard between each one. I live this life. You know, I every single time I go out, I'm watched. We know that we're surveyed. We know that security is a constant concern. We know that our phones might always not work. And then on the other side, as we travel around China, I can see what this country can do. It can build thousands of kilometres of train track in 1 year. It can, it's really a renewable superpower, which is key for the United Kingdom as it tries to kind of build more renewables in the likes of solar panels and wind turbines. And also, it's keen to import electric vehicles. The real trap for Sir Keir Starmer will be to ensure that where we've seen with others is that when it comes to doing trade with China, you know, put in some guardrails. Because what others have seen is when they do trade, the fear is that China then sells far too much, dumps far too much. And I think when I've spoken to business leaders here, they've said, look, it's not just about perhaps China selling us EVs, it's about making EVs in the UK. So I think those are the kind of things I'll be watching for in the next few days.
Laura, fascinating. Thank you very much, Laura Bicker, our China correspondent in Beijing.
14 minutes to 7 is the time. The government set out plans to discount business rates for pubs and music venues in England yesterday in Parliament after warnings from the industry and some Labour backbenchers as well, it is fair to say, about the impact of changes made in last year's budget. But the opposition said it was all too little and too late. Here is our parliamentary correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
Around 1,000 pubs have banned Labour MPs from stopping by for a drink in protest at the Chancellor's changes in her November budget. At Treasury Questions in the Commons, Rachel Reeves insisted the government was pouring cash into the wider industry.
We've put £4.3 billion of taxpayers' money into supporting our retail and hospitality sector, including pubs. But we recognise the distinct problems that pubs face, which is why, unlike the previous Conservative government, we are setting out more support.
And the details of that support came a couple of hours later from the Treasury Minister, Dan Tomlinson. He insisted the government had already taken action to soften the impact of the changes on pubs and had decided to phase out, rather than abruptly stop, support they'd started receiving during the pandemic. But there'd been anger from the industry and discontent on the Labour benches about a switch to the way business rates were calculated, so he was announcing a concession. Pubs and music venues in England would now get 15% off their business rates bill from April, with a freeze for 2 years after that.
This support is worth £1,650 for the average pub just next year and will mean that around three quarters of pubs will see their bills either fall or stay the same next year.
There were hear-hears for that, but the minister was about to come unstuck. Like a customer in a cosy pub who's let the afternoon drift away, Dan Tomlinson found himself in unexpected trouble. He'd let his statement run on too long, well over the allotted 10 minutes. And after a couple of warnings from the chair, the speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, made his disapproval clear.
This House should be shown the respect it deserves. And unfortunately, we're not getting it. I'm here to protect members, not for ministers to take advantage. Minister.
Apologising profusely, Dan Tomlinson wrapped up, saying the government understood it was a tough time for other businesses too and would come up with a high street strategy to look at ways to support them. The Shadow Chancellor, the Conservative Sir Mel Stride, was underwhelmed.
Is that it? After all this time, after weeks of telling our local pubs that help was on the way, this is all they get. A temporary sticking plaster that will only delay the pain for a few, while thousands of businesses despair as their bills skyrocket.
He reckoned pubs, despite the change that had just been announced, would still end up with bills 70% higher than they were today, as would other high street shops and businesses. For the Liberal Democrats, Daisy Cooper also wanted more action.
If the government is serious about saving the high street, then this can only be the start. We Liberal Democrats have been warning since the government's first budget that high streets were going to be at risk of the various changes they've made now over the last 18 months.
And Stella Creasy was one of several Labour MPs who wanted extra support for other hospitality businesses.
Like the cafes and community centres and soft play centres, I'm sure he does not want to be the minister responsible for sending toddlers into pubs because the other places that their parents might take them during the day have closed down. That would not be in anybody's interest.
A Conservative, Mark Pritchard, wondered.
I'm not sure whether the minister has volunteered yet for Strictly Come Dancing. Because from the government of U-turn, today we've seen a half-turn or a reverse turn or a pivot, as it's known in ballroom dancing.
But whatever it was called, Mark Pritchard reckoned it was too little too late for many of his local pubs, which had already decided to close their doors. A Labour MP, Luke Charters, praised two of his local landlords in Yorkshire and thought he knew who was really to blame for the current squeeze.
The reality is the Tories created a ticking time bomb on business rates, then walked away like someone who spilled a pint and left us to mop it up. Exactly. Does the Minister agree with me that this is a government determined to back the legendary landlords in Britain, just like Gary and Adam?
The Minister did agree, so maybe only 998 more landlords to win round.
Elisa McCarthy reporting from yesterday in Parliament. It's 10 minutes to 7. Just a look through the papers this morning and some of the stories, for instance, on the front page of The Guardian. A very powerful image under the headline, Mass Murder, Medics Reveal Grim Reality of Iran's Hidden Death Toll. The paper says deaths estimated to exceed 30,000 after a surge in regime brutality. And the images of tributes at the Iranian embassy in London honouring people believed to have been killed in Iran amid anti-regime protests. Moving to The Telegraph, as I say, that's very powerful indeed, though. Some analysis inside about the trip of Keir Starmer to China by David Blair, the chief foreign affairs commentator, who talks about Britain's failure to crack the China market reflects the success of Xi's Made in China policy, something we'll be exploring, designed to ensure that his country produces everything for itself. The strategy raises a question for the rest of the world. How can you trade successfully with a gigantic country whose ultimate goal is to buy nothing from you?
Going back to the news from Iran, there's a specific person that the Daily Telegraph focuses on who has been killed, it seems. Iranian security forces, they say, shot dead a teenage motorcycle influencer who posted videos of herself online without a headscarf. This according to human rights groups. Her name is Diana Bahador. She's only 19. She was known online as Baby Rider and had a lot of followers. From her pictures of herself riding a motorbike, 150,000 of them watching her post videos about her love of motorbikes, performing stunts and tricks while riding without a headscarf, both, of course, legally prohibited for women in Iran. And there was a final post on January the 6th, and human rights groups say that she was later killed by the security forces. Since I'm in Wales, I suppose I should give you a couple of headlines from the Welsh papers as well, Emma. So the National here saying that the Tories are accusing the Welsh First Minister of ushering in a breakup of the UK. This is remarks that Eluard Morgan has made recently about the potential for the UK to break up if the Nationalists win power, if Plaid Cymru win power here in the Senate elections, but also demanding more powers from the UK government as a way to neutralise that threat. And the Tories saying that's the wrong way to go about it. We'll be hearing from her at 8:30. And the other thing, the state of Welsh rugby just seems to go from bad to worse. But it is where
I was actually wondering if you were going to mention this.
Well, it's the headline. I mean, it is the headline in Wales Online. Ospreys, which is essentially the Swansea, well, it's a bit more than Swansea, isn't it? So Swansea, Port Talbot, Neath, Bridgend, all of those fine rugby names from the past. Ospreys potentially now fighting for its future. Well, it is fighting for its future, and lots of the club's stars, including people that everyone will have heard of, Shane Williams, Gavin Henson, etc., now saying that Ospreys must not be allowed to die. And it is. I mean, it is properly front page news here, at least in some of the better papers.
And you didn't write it. Thank you for that, Justin. The view from Wales this morning, which we're very grateful to have. It's 7 minutes to seven. Let's turn our attention to something the government's trying for all of us. AI intelligence, artificial intelligence rather, that doesn't sound intelligent, did it? Training courses. Sound appealing? They are being made available, these AI courses, to every adult in the UK. Well, who better than our technology editor, Zoe Kleiman, to give them a go?
So I think the first thing to say is the fact that there are 600 different courses available shows you just how difficult this task is of trying to upskill millions of workers, all of whom are on a different journey, not only in terms of what they need to use AI for in their jobs, but also what jobs they're doing and what level they're at already. So you have to go in through a bit of a login process where you say what kind of industry you work in, what job you have, and also, you know, how experienced you are with AI already. So I said that I was an AI leader, clearly, in the creative industries. And the first two courses, clearly, of course, the first two courses it recommended to me were several days long and not free. So I'm ashamed to say I haven't yet done those for you. But I did have a look at some of the others that are available. Some of them are super short. They're not all bespoke courses that have been created for the government. You know, they take you through to, for example, Microsoft's learning platform. Interestingly, a number of the courses I had a peek at said that they were themselves at least partly generated by AI. And certainly some of the video-led ones featured an AI-led presenter. The person I saw pop up a few times is a very affable AI video character called Andrew, who sort of talks you through various things. I mean, a lot of the courses that I saw were quite basic, I suppose, very clear descriptors of how you would use a particular type of AI and a little bit about, you know, how it works technically. But there were some that featured exercises, so you had to download documents so that you could use the documents in the exercises. So, you know, pretty comprehensive training, but not all created from scratch for this portal. I would describe it probably as more of a gateway to other resources.
Do you think that it's answering a need in the sense of course, you know, there are lots of people who don't know anything at all about AI, but is this the way to go about it? What can you say about that sort of context from the industry and from the government?
It's a very clear message that we've all got to get on this bus, isn't it? You know, the government is pushing hard, not only for the UK to be an AI superpower, in its words, but also for industries, for businesses to be using it to generate more efficiency and ultimately to, I guess, try and make more money. So I think it shows how committed the UK is to this technology. It's certainly not going away. And it is a resource that contains free content for people to use. And I guess that's supposed to be an incentive for people to check it out. Ultimately, it's not mandatory, is it? You know, nobody's going to know. I think there are some courses, if you do them, you get a virtual badge if you're interested in that kind of reward. But it's not something that's going to necessarily give you a huge advantage, although clearly the knowledge will, because increasingly we're hearing that AI skills are part of interview processes. You know, I spoke to a boss in Silicon Valley who said he asks every single person who comes to interview for a job, what AI skills do you have? Which tools do you use? And which ones would you use for this particular job? That's every person coming through the door.
When you say what AI skills, or what do you actually mean by that? Because a lot of people are hearing AI is going to take their jobs, meaning AI in some way has got their skills. But what skills do you need to use AI?
I think it's a fundamental level now. In many jobs, particularly sort of administrative jobs, creative jobs, you would be expected to either know or learn how to use it to help you do what you're doing, whether that is how to get an AI tool to craft you an email or generate some marketing copy for you or help you with spreadsheets or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing in your role. How would an AI tool accompany you doing that? Which AI tool is the best one for doing it, or which one is the one that your company wants you to use to do it? And are you proficient in knowing what to do when you're confronted with that little box that says, how can I help you?
which is just a huge thing that we've discussed many times on the programme and will continue to do as to whether that's the right thing or not, for instance, to be using it to make copy, because you also have to be aware of all of the pitfalls and the accuracy issues as well. But it's fascinating. And there'll be people who obviously debate whether this is the right move for the government to be taking. Thank you very much, Zoe Kleinman.
Thank you.
2 minutes to seven. Chris Fawkes has the weather. Morning again, Chris.
Good morning, Justin. Yeah, Storm Chandra mostly out of the way, but it's left a legacy of flooding problems. There will be further disruption today. There are over 100 flood warnings in force across England, the vast majority of these across southern areas of England. Another 3 warnings in force for Wales and 8 in Scotland. Aberdeenshire looking pretty wet as well. Now, I say Chandra's mostly out of the way because we actually have a weather front today across the northeast of Scotland that is still associated with Chandra, bringing rain to Aberdeenshire and Orkney. The weather front's very slow moving today, so it stays wet for a good chunk of the day, and it's pretty windy as well. Eventually the rain will start to push up towards Shetland later on. There are some showers working across the Hebrides and the Highlands, but I think for the majority of Scotland, actually, it's an improving weather picture today. Most areas will become dry with spells of sunshine. A reasonable day as well for Northern Ireland, England and Wales. After a cold, locally frosty and icy start to the day, we're looking at a lot of dry weather with spells of sunshine. There will be some showers though working into southwest England, and there will be some for southern parts of Wales. It's not really going to do much to worsen the flooding situation at all, but nevertheless, I know it's going to be a bit of a worry for people seeing the rain coming down again. It's the last thing you want with the flooding problems that we have. Temperatures today around 7 to 9 Celsius pretty widely. Got my eyes on what's happening for Thursday and for Friday. Another couple of weather systems coming in, both bringing around 10 to 20 millimetres of rain to southwest England. So that could cause some further flooding issues here. That's the latest.
Chris, thank you.
It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 28th of January. The headlines this morning: Sir Keir Starmer is heading to Beijing to reset relations with China, but critics say he's being too soft on an untrustworthy partner. President Trump says he'll de-escalate a little bit in Minneapolis, where his immigration agents have killed 2 protesters. And the government is setting out a shake-up of the way that vets display their prices.
Indeed. Coming up also in the next hour, all morning we will be taking the temperature, or rather Justin will be, in Wales ahead of the country's most competitive election. We'll hear from key political players, but also voters looking ahead to the Senedd contest in May.
Pessimism and fear, really. It is worry. We live in strange times.
Why, though? Why pessimism and fear?
The one thing that concerns me now is the push to extremes.
And we'll be talking about a pioneering approach to protecting birds like the northern lapwing. It's not tweet of the day. We're still here at the Today programme. But can endangered birds be homed on abandoned coal barges? Well, it's one way to avoid paying ground rent, we thought about. But that's a lot more to say, I'm sure, on that. Not least hearing the sounds of nature, always welcome. But the sounds of Lisa Costello reading the BBC News is what we can offer you at this point.
Sir Keir Starmer will arrive in China in the coming hours to start the first visit to the country by a British Prime Minister since Theresa May in 2018. Sir Keir, who will meet President Xi tomorrow, argues previous governments have blown hot and cold in their approach to Beijing and that a consistent relationship is vital. The government was criticised for approving a new Chinese embassy in London despite security concerns about its location, and the Conservatives say Sir Keir is kowtowing to China. Our political editor Chris Mason is travelling with the Prime Minister.
This trip marks the latest and most important moment in the government's attempt to deepen the UK's relationship with China. The Chancellor, the Deputy Prime Minister and the Business Secretary have all been already. Now it's the Prime Minister's turn. He's expressed his frustration at what he sees as a dereliction of duty from recent Conservative governments in shutting out Beijing. He points out the Canadian Prime Minister and French President have both been recently, and says the UK had become an outlier in its outlook on China among comparable Western economies. Dozens of British outfits, corporate and cultural, are represented on this trip, including Barclays, Jaguar Land Rover and the Royal Shakespeare Company. Sir Keir Starmer's argument is China is one of the world's biggest economic players, so a strategic and consistent relationship is in the UK's national interest. And he insists engaging with Beijing allows issues such as human rights abuses to be raised with them. But the Conservatives counter that with the recent approval of a new Chinese mega-embassy in central London, Sakir's approach amounts to what they call surrender, when China, as they put it, poses a serious threat to our national security.
President Trump says his administration is going to, in his words, de-escalate a little bit in Minneapolis, where tensions are high following the deaths of two protesters, Renee Good and Alex Pretty, at the hands of federal agents. The new head of the Immigration Enforcement Operation, Tom Homan, is replacing the Border Patrol Chief, Greg Bovino. Our correspondent Tom Bateman reports from Minneapolis.
When Donald Trump was asked about the killing of Alex Pretty, he said he certainly shouldn't have been carrying a gun. The comments will alarm those calling for an independent investigation into his death. They're also remarkable from a Republican leader strongly allied with gun rights groups, which have already signalled their disapproval about how in this case the administration appears to have bristled against the constitutionally protected right to carry a weapon. Mr. Trump said the death of Mr. Pretty was a very unfortunate incident, but he has at the same time veered into commenting on the political views of the two dead Americans or their families, without explaining why this would have any bearing on the issue of their killings at the hands of federal agents. He said of 37-year-old Renee Good, her parents were big Trump fans, but that she had become, in the president's view, radicalized.
A Democratic member of Congress for Minnesota, Ilhan Omar, has been sprayed with an unknown liquid while delivering a speech at a town hall event in Minneapolis. She was unharmed. A man has been arrested. One of the world's leading technology bosses has warned that AI share prices are probably a bubble and that there will be carnage if it bursts. The chief executive of Cisco, Chuck Robbins, has told the BBC that while some companies won't survive, artificial intelligence will be bigger than the internet. He's been speaking to our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
Cisco is one of the world's leading technology companies behind some of the critical IT infrastructure enabling the day-to-day use of AI. It was hit when the original dot-com bubble burst in 2000, but survived and thrived after losing 80% of its value. Now its boss, Chuck Robbins, confidant of President Trump, says while AI technology is unstoppable, there may be some financial turbulence ahead.
Every major technology revolution that we see feels like hype to begin with. And there's been a lot of discussion about, is this a bubble? And the answer is probably yes. There's carnage along the way, but it is going to be bigger than the internet.
Mr. Robbins said some jobs were already being eliminated by AI, particularly in areas like customer services, where he said companies would need fewer people. But he urged people not to be afraid of the technology and embrace it in their lives.
The government is to offer AI training courses to every adult in the UK, with ministers saying they want to ensure people can seize the benefits of the technology. The online courses have been designed by companies including Google and Microsoft to teach basic AI skills, such as how to use artificial intelligence in the workplace or to create content. President Zelensky has condemned a deadly Russian drone attack on a passenger train in eastern Ukraine, calling it an act of terrorism. Four people were killed and several are missing. Our correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports from Kiev.
The train was travelling east towards the Donbas region when two drones struck near the rails, then a third drone hit a carriage directly, setting it on fire. Images from the scene show it smashed and in flames, and a soldier helping a group of passengers to safety from further down the train. They include a woman in floods of tears with a tiny baby in a carry cot. This route is used by local residents, as well as soldiers heading home on leave from the front lines or their wives and girlfriends travelling east to see them. Ukraine's railways were always thought relatively safe, even in this all-out war, but not anymore. Volodymyr Zelensky is calling this drone attack an act of terrorism by Russia, for which he says there can be no military justification.
The Ministry of Defence has announced the death of an army officer following an incident at a firing range in Northumberland. Officials said Captain Philip Gilbert Muldowney, who was 25 and from the 4th Regiment Royal Artillery, died on Sunday. The MOD said it was investigating.
Hundreds of flood warnings and alerts are in place after Storm Chandra brought heavy rain. A major incident has been declared in Somerset because of flooding, which has affected dozens of properties. There are fears that a drop in temperatures could cause icy conditions this morning in areas which were hit by yesterday's rain, and there's a warning of more downpours in southwest England later this week. Jed Stevenson lives in Colleton in East Devon, which has been cut off by flooding.
We're kind of in a bit of a dip, a bit of a valley, so it runs in towards us, any of the water, and it was pretty incredible. It looked like an island. We were just surrounded by lakes everywhere, and the schools were closed, and you couldn't get out of Colleton, you couldn't get into Colleton.
The government is launching an 8-week consultation on its plans to make vet prices clearer and to overhaul how veterinary practices are regulated. These changes, which are the first for 60 years, come after hundreds of pet owners contacted the BBC to share their frustrations about price increases and the standard of care. Our correspondent Coletta Smith reports.
While individual vets and nurses are currently regulated, the practices themselves are not. Given that 60% of veterinary surgeries are owned by six companies, there have been growing calls to shift the power back to customers. There'll be a requirement for businesses to reveal who owns them and to publish a clear list of prices for basic procedures so customers can compare costs. Veterinary nurses will be registered so they can carry out simple procedures without the need for an expensive veterinary surgeon, and practices will need a clear complaints process. It's hoped with a separate investigation by the Competition and Markets Authority publishing its final recommendations in March that the two announcements may help make the system fairer and cheaper for pet owners.
Coletta Smith reporting.
Lisa, thank you. It's 9 minutes past seven. Sir Keir Starmer will arrive in China shortly, marking the start of the first visit to the country by a British Prime Minister in 8 years since Theresa May's last visit in 2018. It is history in the making as he tries to build ties with the world's second most powerful country at a time when the global order is being shaken up, largely driven by Donald Trump. Sir Keir Starmer will meet President Xi tomorrow and has been urged to champion human rights, among other things. It's a major statement, this trip, but is it the right one? And can the Prime Minister carry it off? Sir Keir Starmer has faced major criticism for being too soft on Beijing after approving a new giant embassy in London amidst claims that China's been spying on Britain, including hacking the phones of senior Downing Street officials. And yet the government argues it is right to try and build a strategic and consistent relationship with the superpower. And Sir Keir Starmer says the trip will make Britain richer. I'm joined now by Lord Beamish, a Labour peer and chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee. Good morning.
Morning.
You have warned China is the biggest intelligence threat that the UK faces. What do you make of the justification for this trip?
Well, China is, the world's second largest economy. It's our third largest trading partner. Our report in 2023 was clear about the threat on security levels. And the conclusion is this: we've got to have a clear-eyed approach to China, but also be vigilant about the security threat that it poses.
How do you go and do that in these sorts of trips, which end up looking, you know, to the outsider's lens, very cosy, very friendly, and yet we are at odds on many things, from human rights through to the surveillance that you've just talked about?
Well, I think it's an opportunity for the Prime Minister to raise issues around human rights and other concerns that we have. But the alternative is, I think, a very strange argument is I think what the Conservatives and some of the China hawks are saying is that somehow we ignore China, that somehow we pull the duvet over our head and hope they'll go away. They won't.
So you think this trip is correct?
I do. We've got to keep engagement. We've got to be very clear, though, in terms of our domestic interests. And in, for example, in the economy, we've got to ensure that we protect those industries which are vital to our national interest. And we've got to go away clearly that some of the problems, I think, that we have are result of the golden age under David Cameron, when we did not have the, balance right between protecting our national interests and the economic well-being.
It's just when you talk about, you know, what you know of the security risks that China poses, visiting there and engaging in the way that you're talking, you know, those two things don't necessarily seem to go together. And if I could just ask you specifically about what I mentioned in my introduction, the hacking, the reporting of hacking of phones of senior Downing Street officials. What do you know of that?
Well, I'm not going to say anything on air about things like that. But what I will say is that our security services are very vigilant to the threat, both in the cyberspace, but also in terms of the threat to individuals here. And the
won't say anything on air, I understand, but it's true then.
Well, I'm not going to comment on things. My committee takes evidence and sees information at a highly classified level. I think it would be irresponsible of me to talk about that in detail.
But if you were reading The Telegraph, where you know this report originated from, and you were appraising yourself certainly of your report, let's say, and the threat, you know, you don't have to be a China hawk to feel deeply uncomfortable about why on earth should we be going on a trip when we're talking about a state that wants to build and is building a super embassy in London and surveys at the highest levels of Downing Street.
Well, no, the Chinese are very clear. They want to become an economic and technical superpower by 2049. What we've got to be very clear of is that what do we do? Just ignore them? I don't think that's an approach. What we need to be is vigilant. And you talk about a super embassy, you know, the Intelligence Security Committee has looked at this issue in terms of the security aspects. We're content that ministers and our security services did the full appraisal of those threats. As I say, we've got to be clear-eyed and vigilant. We know what China does, not just here, but internationally, and we need to push back hard.
Have we been vigilant enough, though? That's what I'm trying to get to.
In the past, no, I don't think we have.
In the last 18 months while we've had Labour in power?
No, I think things have changed because I think the golden era opened up much of our economy and academia without any questions being asked. Then we went into this strange period where, you know, all contact was withdrawn.
Yes.
And I don't think that's what we've got to do is make sure that we protect those industries and sectors which we need to in the UK with our allies and also make sure that we push back hard in areas that you raise, for example, like human rights.
Well, we'll see what can be done. I will be following, of course, this trip closely. Lord Beamish, Labour peer and chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, thank you. And I'll be speaking to a member of the Cabinet, Liz Kendall, just after 8 o'clock.
7:15 is the time now. It is difficult to overstate the size of the political event about to take place here in Wales, where I am this morning. The polls suggesting that Labour could lose the May the 7th elections for the Senate and lose badly. That, of course, is not set in stone. It may not happen. But it's never happened before, not since devolution, never in any general election either, since 1920. Reform are polling better, and so are Plaid Cymru. And Rhian ap Iorwerth, the leader of Plaid Cymru, is here in our Cardiff studio. Good morning to you.
Very good morning to you.
Is a vote for Plaid Cymru at this election a vote for separation?
No, we've made it very clear that this isn't an election about independence. This is an election about getting to grips with the problems that we face in health and in education and creating jobs. But it's also an election about change. Now, that doesn't mean that we're having to sell the notion of change to the people of Wales in this election. That feels as if it's a foregone conclusion, that people are desperate now for that change after 100 plus years of Labour domination in Wales and, of course, 27 years almost of Labour first ministers in Wales. The question is what kind of change that represents. Will it be that sort of vision-based, hope-based, Wales-focused offer from Plaid Cymru or, you know, frankly, the chaos on offer from Reform?
Well, to which Labour would say, well, hang on a second, when you talk about vision and when you talk about hope, we, Labour, are talking about real progress because only we can speak to the government in Westminster and get the money that those hopes that can be based on. And you would not be in a position to do that.
There's a fundamental problem there. One, we have seen since Keir Starmer came into power and the promise of this partnership in power that would resolve all of Wales's ills, that Labour in Wales has failed, you know, abjectly to get anything out of UK government. At a time, actually, when an SNP government in Scotland has been able to get more out on capital spend, for example. There's something fundamentally undemocratic about thinking, well, you know, this government will only give something to Wales if it is able to hoard power there too. And exactly this week, in the discussion on devolving policing to Wales, where Plaid Cymru is making the case. Commission after commission have made the case for policing to be devolved to Wales. The Home Secretary says, no, I'm not going to do it. And a Labour MP was quoted saying, no, we're not going to do it, especially given we're unlikely to be running Wales. So that hoarding of power is more important than what's right for policing in Wales. Now, that is a shocking indictment of Labour's attitude towards Wales.
What can you promise then when it comes to change? If Plaid Cymru are in government, either with Labour or possibly even with the Greens, but if you are able to do things in Wales after this election, what will your top priority be and how will you do it?
In terms of getting to grips with the issues that we face in Wales, we've made a number of priorities known. First one I think people would expect is to get to grips with the deep problems that we face in health. And we've got a plan in place that will, A, deal with those waiting lists that are such a problem to people.
Without more money from Westminster?
We will always make the case for that fair funding.
But if you don't get it, can you still make a change?
Yeah, we plan to use what we have better. Essentially, that's what we have to do. We make the case for fair funding. We make the case for the ability to invest in our railways, you know, rather than prop up HS2 in England and so on.
But if you don't get any of those extra funds, you're saying you can still make a difference without them?
We have to plan for that. Our plan on childcare, giving children the best start in life, helping parents back to work. Expensive, but it's something we've decided must be a priority if we're to help families through the cost of living crisis and make a difference to their day-to-day lives. Setting up a new development agency for Wales, not a big cost, if you like, but a change in attitude towards stopping the stagnation that's held our economy back. So there are a host of things that we believe we are able to do. And in having those relationships, constructive relationships with whoever is the UK Prime Minister, we will be able to make the case far more transparently than the current Labour First Minister does, because she's always trying to keep things steady and not rock the boat with Keir Starmer. My loyalty will always be to the people of Wales.
Will you bin the 20-mile-an-hour limit? Because again and again, I was around out and about yesterday, again and again people mention it as being something that annoys them. And of course it came not just as a result of Labour, but also Plaid Cymru very much supported it at the time. It is your 20-mile-an-hour limit too. Do you still own it?
Well, it's Labour-owned in the way that it was done, and that's the key thing. I support widespread 20-mile-per-hour. Lives are being saved.
Serious
injuries. The way it was done was very, very poor. And Plaid Cymru actually put down a motion in the Senate right at the start when it was being introduced, saying, you need to review this because it feels unreasonable in many places. There have been some changes since. But as a principle, it was the right thing to do. But it was a government that didn't talk to the people of Wales about how it should be done and weren't clear enough about how it should be actually put into practice, which is why you have different ways that it was implemented in different parts of Wales.
Rina Piora, thank you very much, and we'll be talking to the First Minister at 8:30.
Looking forward to that. At 7:20, though, let's turn our attention back to business, because the Treasury-backed National Wealth Fund is announcing a shift in focus this morning to try and drive more than £100 billion worth of investment into the UK economy. Will Bain is back and has more on that. Will.
Morning again, Emma. Yes, this is the fund, formerly known as the British Infrastructure Bank. It exists to try and encourage private investment in infrastructure by providing financing for projects in line with government policies, including things like regional growth and clean energy. And Oliver Holborn is its chief executive. Oliver, morning.
Good morning, Will.
A shift in focus then suggests that the focus hasn't been quite right in the past, wasn't it? So what have been some of the mistakes and what are you looking to rectify?
Actually, I think the National Wealth Fund, since it was renamed, as you suggested last year, has done a really good job at getting capital deployed into areas where, consistent with the industrial strategy, we're helping the UK to grow and to consume more energy. But the shift in focus is really to enable us to go faster. We want to fully deploy the capital that we've been endowed with over the next 5 years. We want to do it in a more focused way. Today outlines the sectors where we think we can be most catalytic and active over the next few years.
Where are those?
A number of them, actually, Will. So across ports, carbon capture, uses and storage, battery manufacturing and electric vehicle supply chain, in the grid, nuclear, transport, infrastructure and place-based regeneration. So we have three ambitions. One is unlocking growth opportunities on the pathway to clean energy. The second is accelerating place-based investment across all four nations.
And this is going to be direct investment now, right, as well? Because in the past, you've kind of invested in sort of other investors along the way. Is that part of this shift too? You're going to do the investing directly now rather than investing in someone else?
That was always the intention, that the majority of our capital will be deployed directly rather than through funds, and that will continue to be the case. There may be exceptions, but they will be exceptions rather than what we are seeking to do.
John, if you heard our conversation at 6 o'clock with Antonio Simoesh from Legal & General talking about risk, and it's something the Treasury Select Committee have talked about around the National Wealth Fund as well, isn't it? Risk appetite is also required for the National Wealth Fund to be catalytic, the Treasury Select Committee said. Are you willing to take a bit more risk?
We are certainly willing to take the level of risk that we need to reach our ambitions. You know, we take significantly more risk than other commercial financial institutions in the UK, on some measures up to four or five times. You've seen us do that in various investments, for example, you know, in the digital and technology sector, and we intend to continue to do that. Importantly, Will, we need to crowd in investment. So we need to make sure that each pound of taxpayers' money that we invest stretches as far as it possibly can. And so we're looking for, you know, the Legal & Generals and Avivas of this world, alongside other investors, you know, to come in alongside us and share those risks and opportunities to help the company grow and consume more clean energy.
Oliver Holman, Chief Executive of the National Wealth Fund, thanks so much for your time.
Will, thank you to you. And 23 minutes past seven. In recent days, human rights groups have been warning that the final death toll in the Iran protests could soar into the tens of thousands as part of the brutal suppression as the state security forces tried to stop those uprisings. As one woman in Iran told the BBC yesterday, "We all know someone who was killed in the protests." What is life like right now in Iran, though? Joe Inwood has been trying to find out.
Dangling precariously from a lamppost in Tehran, a man smashes CCTV cameras as a crowd cheers his act of defiance. This was the height of the protest in early January, which, for a while, looked like they might bring down the Iranian regime. Then came a violent response unlike anything seen in this country before. Thousands were killed, many of them shot by security forces. The internet was shut down, leaving the protesters to die in darkness.
I don't really remember how we used to live before this genocide.
But 20 days on, and their voices are getting out. The BBC heard from a student from the north of Iran. She's in her first year of university, is passionate and fluent, but for her own safety, you cannot hear her real voice. She once believed the protests could bring down the government. She has now lost that hope.
I think we have all realised this regime won't leave because of street protests. They will kill us as much as they can, but they won't leave. I think we have sacrificed enough young people, old people. It was a genocide. I think street protests are not going to work.
For now, that does seem to be the case. It's still not clear exactly how many people died, but some estimates run into the tens of thousands. It's left her traumatized and racked with guilt.
We're all addicted to checking the news every 5 minutes. And after checking the news, we feel guilty about the fact that we were not killed. We feel like the regime is cracking our bones after hearing the stories of somebody's life that is taken away. We are all concerned about how we are going to return to life, return to our jobs, return to our schools.
The regime has been trying to give a sense of life returning to normal. But as people drive through Revolution Square, they're greeted by a huge new mural. It depicts the American Stars and Stripes, made out of a destroyed aircraft carrier. It bears the words, "If you sow the wind, you will reap the whirlwind." Mohammad Reza is a young man with swept back hair. He was not afraid of sharing his anti-American views with a news agency crew.
"Any threat that America has made against us are only words, because in the 12-day war, they saw the full extent of our power. Any threat, any action they take, we will not leave unanswered."
By the way, there's another beautiful armada floating beautifully toward Iran right now.
But for the student we heard from, whether the US will or won't attack Iran is now immaterial. It has been many days and countless deaths since Donald Trump promised support encouraged them to the streets, but did nothing.
In the first days, many of us were waiting for foreign attack. Not everyone agreed with it, as we knew there could be serious consequences. However, the consequences of a foreign attack could not be worse than the consequences of the internal repression. Today, any statements coming from the United States or from President Trump make people furious. It feels as if public trust has been betrayed. The US president must be responsible for what he said, because thousands of people found the courage to go into streets because of his words.
For now, the protest movement seems to have been successfully crushed in the most brutal fashion. With the internet still down, there is much that remains unclear, including the true cost the Iranian people paid for asking for change.
We all believe that this regime is finished, but we don't know when. We just need to know the real number who were killed. I believe that in dark days, all of us need to know what has truly happened to our country and our people, whether the bodies of each and every victim will be returned to their families. Nothing matters more to me right now.
Joe Inwood reporting.
And that brings us to 29 minutes past seven to the Sport and Mike.
Justin, thank you. We told you last hour that Novak Djokovic was on the ropes at the Australian Open. He was two sets down to Lorenzo Musetti in Melbourne. It looked like the 10-time champion was heading out in the quarterfinals. But Abigail Johnson, Djokovic has survived. He is through to the last four. What's happened?
The recipient of a miracle, Novak Djokovic. He said that Lorenzo Musetti was by far the better player and that he was on his way home, having had a medical timeout for his own right foot after going down two sets to love to the number five seeded Italian. But that was when Musetti seemed to jar something at the top of his right leg. It was written all over his face as he sat down, having been broken for 2-1, that he was in physical discomfort. And just a game and a half later, he did throw in the towel. So Novak Djokovic, who actually got a walkover through the fourth round after young Jakub Mencik was forced to pull out of the tournament, has been able to progress to the semi-finals without winning a set today. His hopes are just about still alive as he targets the elusive 25th Grand Slam title.
All right, Abigail, many thanks. Djokovic then living a charmed life in Melbourne. You can hear coverage of the Australian Open continuing right now on BBC Sounds. We, though, are going to reflect on a series victory for England's cricketers yesterday out in Sri Lanka. A 53-run win in the third ODI yesterday means that they take the series 2-1. Kevin Howells was watching the match for the BBC and joins us now. Kevin, this match very much the story of two Yorkshiremen, wasn't it? An impressive, unbeaten centuries for Joe Root yesterday and the captain, Harry Brook.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good series to watch. Short series, just three matches all played at the same stadium, the Premadasa in Colombo. And contrasting, certainly yesterday's compared with the first two in terms of the pitch, which Harry Brook described on Saturday as being the worst ODI pitch he'd ever played on. He wasn't thinking that yesterday when England scored 357 runs, only losing three wickets. You're quite right to focus on Root and Brook. I think England generally would be very excited also about young Jacob Bethell scoring those 65 runs early on. But Joe Root is just so prolific in that part of the world. So good against spin, accumulating runs. Scored 111 not out of 108 balls. But that included also Brook joining him, scoring 136 not out, 66 deliveries, 11 fours, 9 sixes. They scored 130. I say they, mainly Brook scored 130 runs in the last 10 overs. It was phenomenal. And Sri Lanka gave it a good go, in fairness. Mm. They had to keep their cool, Harry Brook, the captain, and England, but eventually they came up short. So finally this winter, whether it be the men's or the women's cricket for England, we get something to enjoy as England supporters.
Now, Kevin, of all the people I wasn't expecting to talk about in the sports news this morning, the cult 1990s WWE wrestler Stone Cold Steve Austin would probably be right up there. But we do have to mention him because Brooke mimicked a celebration, didn't he? Made famous by the American, basically involves drinking two beers in a very exaggerated manner. And this is significant because Brooke was recently involved in a late night drinking scandal in New Zealand where he was punched by a bouncer, for which he had to apologise. Was this ill-advised from Brooke or just a bit of fun, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure anybody would advise him to do what he did. And I'm pleased you probably had to look up as well Stone Cold Steve Austin and the beer smash. I knew absolutely nothing about it beforehand. And we should point out, by the way, it wasn't cans of beer that Harry had out there in the middle. He was mimicking this using his two batting gloves as well, of course. But yeah, I mean, there was accusations of that drinking culture with the England Ashes squad in Australia, which they refute. But Brook himself, in that incident involving a nightclub bouncer in New Zealand, which he himself has said he understands why fans would be annoyed on hearing about that. He's put on a final warning from the ECB, also a very big fine. So this is serious stuff as far as people looking on from afar. But according to Joe Root, his teammate who was asked about it in the press conference afterwards, he said basically, and he was hoping that people wouldn't look at this as if there's any malice to it, this was Harry Brooks' way of sort of linking again, trying to regain the trust of his teammates by having a bit of a laugh about it. But, you know, people will look at it and think, really, was that the best thing for you to do, Harry?
Brooks back on the beers, say the Telegraph on their sports section this morning. They have certainly noticed that. We shall see what awaits us in the three-match T20 series, which gets underway between England and Sri Lanka on Friday afternoon. Kevin Howells, many thanks for that.
I just love that reference to the wrestling. Anyway, thanks, Mike. Looking ahead to Saturday morning, Radio 4 journeys into the BBC archives.
I'm Greg James, and I'm back with a new series of Rewinder, the programme where the stories of the week inspire a deep dive into the BBC archive. This time, we find a ping-pong-playing cat.
She's much the same as any friendly mouser, but with one important difference.
A sonic boom test.
But do you think you've achieved anything at all?
And a key dramatic moment.
No, every Linton on the face of the earth might perish before I forsake Heathcliff.
If only it weren't accompanied by quite so much background noise. The new series of Rewinder, starting on Saturday morning at 10:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
To the weather, it's going to be mostly dry today, patchy cloud and bright spells, but the chance of rain in the early morning and the late afternoon for some.
Coming up before nine, we'll be talking to the UK's chief vet on whether her colleagues should be more transparent on their prices.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4, Emma Barnett in London, Justin Webb in Cardiff, and at just coming up to 25 to 8, the news from Lisa Costello.
Sir Keir Starmer is due to arrive in China in a few hours on the first visit by a British Prime Minister since Theresa May travelled there in 2018. Sir Keir, who will meet President Xi tomorrow, says a steady and consistent relationship with Beijing is vital after what he describes as years of hot and cold policy from previous governments. The Conservatives have accused him of surrendering to China by approving a new embassy in London despite security concerns about its location. President Trump says his administration will de-escalate a little bit in Minneapolis amid a backlash over two fatal shootings of protesters by federal immigration agents. In a move aimed at easing tensions, the border czar, Tom Homan, has arrived in the city to replace the hardline Border Patrol commander, Greg Bovino. One of the world's leading tech bosses has warned that AI share prices are probably a bubble and that there could be carnage if it bursts. Cisco's chief executive, Chuck Robbins, has told the BBC that while some companies won't survive, artificial intelligence will end up bigger than the internet. He said AI technology was unstoppable. The government says it aims to reach 10 million workers with its artificial intelligence training programme by 2030. Many of the online courses will be free, teaching basic AI skills such as content creation and how to handle administrative tasks. President Zelensky has condemned a Russian drone attack on a passenger train in Ukraine, calling it an act of terrorism. Four people were killed in the strike. The train was travelling towards the Donbass region in the east of the country. The government is launching an 8-week consultation on its plans to make vet prices clearer and to overhaul regulation. Businesses will have to reveal who owns them and publish clear pricing for basic procedures so that customers can compare costs. Additionally, veterinary nurses will be registered to carry out simple procedures without the need for an expensive veterinary surgeon.
Lisa, thank you. 23 minutes to 8 is the time. We've come to Cardiff today because the election campaign underway here for the Senedd, the election to be held on May the 7th, is potentially the biggest political event in Wales for generations. Of course, Labour might see off their rivals, but at the moment, looking at the polls, that seems unlikely. And that means for the first time since devolution, Labour will be out of power. Wales is at least contemplating a step into a new political world with Reform, the Greens, Plaid Cymru, or vying to be part of the governing setup. Why? What has happened? Is it Keir Starmer? Is it the local lot? Health is a big issue here. Waiting lists have been high in Wales, of course, but they have started to come down. The number of people waiting more than 4 hours in A&E, though, remains a problem. And there are other issues as well. I've been out and about in Newport hearing the reasons why Wales is on the political move.
We're outside the slate steps of the Senedd, or the Welsh Parliament, and if we look inside the building here, it's a nice glass building, we can see an awful lot of building work happening, and that's because they're essentially ripping up the chamber and building a new one.
Tell us about the building work, because it's very obvious there's a lot going on here, isn't there? We're doing what?
The number of politicians we're getting is expanding. So from 1999 until now, we've had 60 MSs, members of the Senedd. That's expanding to 96, and obviously they need to find new space for them.
This is a really important election, plainly. Tell us why.
It's the first competitive election we've had in Wales, almost at any level, for about 100 years, or at least let's just say in the devolution period since 1999, where Labour have won every election. They've won every general election here as well for 100 years. But for the first time now, we have both polling evidence, survey evidence, but also by-election evidence and what's happened in the rest of the UK, suggesting that Labour might not win, they might not even come second here. And so we're looking at, for the first time, a party other than Labour being the largest party in Wales.
Which is extraordinary and seismic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of the national myth of Wales is that it's tied to left-wing Labour politics. You know, a lot of the Labour Party's own mythology comes from here. And Eireann Bevan, of course, from here, the first ever Labour MP, Keir Hardian leader, elected in Wales. But also for how Wales understands itself and all those strange myths and stories that get tied in with Welsh national identity, and all that could be about to change.
We've come to the outskirts of Newport now, to the Loading Bay Community Cafe, which is in Rogerstone, which is just one of the suburbs, as it were, of Newport. And I'm joined by Liz and Lucy. Liz, tell us what brings you here.
I run mother and baby groups, music groups for children. I'm one of many providers that run out of this space.
Lucy?
I'm actually a representative from Remake Newport. We're a repair cafe in the centre of town.
When you cast your vote in May, what is it that will be absolutely at the top of your mind?
Definitely the policy for improving Newport city centre. It's been allowed to die.
I think a lot of investment tends to centre around Cardiff and Swansea. That's how Newport people feel. Yeah.
Do you think that Labour, who have run Wales since devolution, do you think they're doing a good job?
No. No, and I think you'd really struggle to find anyone that's going to vote for Labour. People are just fed up, and simple things like dentists. Most dentists in Newport now are going over to become private. 20 mile an hour driving on the roads. That was really, really not very well received in Newport. And it's just simple things like that that are really upsetting people.
Lucy, you were nodding through a lot of that. Have you given up on local Labour as opposed to Westminster Labour?
I've given up on Westminster Labour, definitely. I want local Labour to be good, and I know that they're trying, but I feel like they're hampered by Westminster, definitely. We've been Labour here since before I was born, and I want to vote for Labour, but I want them to be better.
Hello.
Afternoon.
Is this Chris?
Yes, me.
I'm Justin.
Hi, Justin.
Very nice to see you. You've got an amazing view, actually.
Yeah, it is quite nice, actually.
Beautiful.
My name's Chris Powell. I've lived in Newport. I'm born and bred.
And we're here because you have had to have hip replacements because you were in really some difficulties.
Yeah, that's correct. I had severe osteoarthritis in both hips. It took me 3 weeks to get a doctor's appointment. He then said to me, you're going to see an orthopaedic surgeon, but it could be up to a year just to see the orthopaedic surgeon. And then the NHS waiting list currently was 2 years for the hip. So I started researching to get it done privately. I knew it was very expensive in the UK, so I came across a surgery in Lithuania. So I made the leap then, and I felt, right, I'm going to go to Lithuania. So I had that done at the end of March 2025, and the other one was done 3 months after that. And since then, I've been a new man.
You're really happy with what has been done for you, but I'm assuming you're not happy with the fact that it couldn't be done here on the NHS that you pay for.
Yeah, I was a bit put out by that because I'm a working man. I've paid in my taxes and national insurance, and I couldn't get what I needed in a timely fashion, if I'm honest. Since we've had a new government in, this time they've said that the NHS waiting lists are improving and quote all these figures, but I don't think I'm the only one. I don't believe anything the government tells me these days about figures.
When you vote this time round here in Wales, and it's for the Welsh Senedd, do national politics impose at all?
I base it on the national UK successive governments. I'm talking about Labour and Conservative. In my opinion, those two parties have let us down. So I'd be looking for someone that suits my politics now. I've given both a try and they both let me down.
As you can hear, there's a change of venue. We've come to Boughton's Music School, where Chris is waiting for us. Tell us first, what's happening here?
This is a music school, running one-to-one music lessons.
Tell us about the election. What matters for you?
The cost of living crisis is an important one. That's affecting people, especially in private businesses like this, to access private businesses like this. I've got a live music venue in Bargoed. The rates are about to go up on that. That's a challenging sector, hospitality.
When you see the big changes that could happen in the Senedd this time round, does it fill you with optimism, pessimism, fear?
Pessimism and fear, really. It is worry. We live in strange times.
Why, though? Why pessimism and fear?
The one thing that concerns me now is the push to extremes. People's views on certain things were effectively ignored for a long time, immigration being the main one.
So when people express fears about it, they were suppressed, effective. Told they were racist, etc.
Yeah, exactly. That was the case 20 years ago. As these things have gone on, and these views have been ignored effectively, they've been pushed to the extremities. And we're now seeing what I view as rather unhelpful political forces like reform. I think the biggest thing is that politicians can't be honest. They're not able to be at election time. They're promising things that probably in their hearts and their heads they know they can't deliver either.
But what would an honest politician say then at this juncture in Wales?
That we're in a unique and particularly difficult time. That there's certain things that we've accepted for years that the state would do, that the state would provide, that perhaps we're in a situation now where we might have to start accepting the state can't do it, or certainly can't do it like it did.
A final thought then, back in Cardiff from Jack Lana of Cardiff University. What is the Senedd potentially going to look like after May?
We don't get many polls in Wales, but the ones that we do, if we take kind of an average, it shows Plaid slightly out ahead competing at Reform, although the gap is within a few percentage points, and then a huge gap to everybody else.
And if it finishes like that in terms of seats, how is Wales governed?
At the moment, if things play out the way they currently look, and there's always those huge caveats on there, it would be Plaid Cymru as the largest party, Reform second largest party, and in terms of governing, probably a Plaid Cymru minority government, and then kind of getting ad hoc support either from Labour or the Greens or the Lib Dems or some combination mishmash of them in order to elect a First Minister, pass budgets, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that was Jack Lana from Cardiff University, is accompanied by the Ducks. And I should say we'll be talking to all the main parties in Wales in the coming days. We heard already from Plaid, didn't we, just after 7 o'clock. We will hear later in this programme, though, from the First Minister, from Labour's Eleanor Morgan, who will be here just after 8:30.
But now it's 14 minutes to 8, and here on the programme we've been speaking a lot about the potential social media ban for under-16s, the rights, the wrongs of putting that into law, as well as the role of phones in schools. On Friday's programme, we want to look in more detail at how this plays out in the home, how parents are handling family use of social media and screen time more generally. If you are a parent or if you're living with younger people or you're trying to control someone around this, it's pretty difficult. We want to hear from you. How are you approaching this? What are the conversations you're having with grandchildren, children, those around you? And what limits or rules do you try to set around social media, screens and phones? Perhaps you're also trying to limit yourself. What is that like at the moment? What's the example you're setting? Be honest. You can send a message or a voice note on WhatsApp on 0330 1234 346. That's 0330 1234 346. I am, of course, encouraging you to use your phones and devices or email us on today@bbc.co.uk. And handily, when you're thinking about what to say, you'll be able to hear on the programme, if you can stay with us for this, after 8 o'clock, from Liz Kendall, the woman in charge, Secretary of State for Technology, amongst other things. So we'll hear what she has to say as well. But 13 minutes to eight means it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Sheikh Ibrahim Moghra, an imam and educator.
Good morning. The cosmetics industry is worth hundreds of billions, and according to one retailer, Generation Alpha are starting to use beauty products at around age 8. Billboards on the back of buses, shop fronts and bus stands, newspapers and magazines, apps on our smart devices, all constantly bombard us with the availability of 1001 products that will work the magic and do wonders for us. Cleansers, mascara, lipstick, anti-aging creams, and the list goes on. Did I mention that I've been married for 36 years? And my dear mother, bless her, she would still like me to moisturize. So how did we get here? I believe it is because of the emphasis and importance that has been placed on our appearance and external beauty, as well as the unrealistic beauty standards women often face. In our household, I'm known to take much longer in front of the mirror when I have a wedding to attend or make a television appearance. I want to look my best. Many of us spend long periods of time, effort and energy and money to try and enhance our looks. Yet we all agree that this beauty is only skin deep and it departs with each passing day. The grays and the wrinkles will keep coming. I think back to my youthful days and how good I looked, even if I say so myself. How proudly I show photographs of old to my children, even those in black and white. People take pride in their visible outer beauty. Yet there is another beauty, the inner beauty, the beauty of the heart. Rather than diminish by the day, it can keep growing to our last breath. It is for each one of us to place value on it. There are no adverts or products on the market for this. When our young are not prepared to leave the house without painting on a face, we would do well to nurture their inner beauty and get them to value and appreciate it more. Someone may look as handsome and beautiful as a prince or princess, but if their heart is filled with hate, anger, jealousy, animosity, greed, miserliness, and revenge, what good is that beauty? To me, that person is ugly. On the other hand, someone may not be as handsome or beautiful, but their heart is filled with love, kindness, respect, friendship, generosity and forgiveness. Now that is a heart of gold. That is truly a beautiful person. The Prophet Muhammad taught that God does not look at our faces, colors, shapes and sizes, nor the size of our wallets, but he looks at our hearts.
And that was Thought for the Day with Sheikh Ibrahim Moghra. Brings us to 10 to 8.
Could it be the biggest shake-up of Britain's vet industry in more than 60 years? That's what the government is promising as it launches an 8-week consultation on its plans to make vet prices clearer, to overhaul how veterinary practices are regulated, and to set out a complaints process for owners. The Competition and Markets Authority has found that vet prices have risen at nearly twice the rate of inflation, leaving many pet owners dreading a trip to the surgery, with prices also varying wildly. Paul Manktelow is a chief vet, or rather the chief vet at Blue Cross, an animal welfare charity. Good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
We've also got Christine Middlemiss on the line, the UK's chief veterinary officer. Christine, hello and welcome.
Morning, Emma.
I thought I'd start with you. I mean, why are prices so different?
Because veterinary practice has changed an awful lot in the last 60 years. 60 years ago, they were in one or two man vet practices owned by vets, very much providing mostly a farm care service. Now we have a huge pet owning public. The kind of investigations we can do and the treatments we can do, say MRI scans in dogs, stem cell treatments for horses and things, vastly changed, and it costs money. And vet, many vet businesses are now not owned by vets, but owned by businesses. And there is no direct regulation for them under the current Veterinary Surgeons Act.
What were you welcome about these changes then?
Oh, I think absolutely that vet businesses and not just individual vets are regulated. Recognition of the vet nurse title and the work that they do. Recognition of other allied professionals we work with, equine dentists, cattle foot trimmers. The intention is that they would be regulated as part of the vet-led team. So a much broader regulation for all those in the vet team that are providing healthcare.
And specifically the pricing and the listing, and so you can compare and see what's fair.
So there will be a requirement to publish the cost of treatments and particularly routine procedures like having your cat spayed, for example, and to provide estimates. And as you said earlier, Emma, a complaints process for owners that are not happy.
Paul, let me bring you in at this point. What do you think the most important change that people could notice quickly? And I suppose, do you have confidence that these changes can happen with how the veterinary practices are owned?
I think most people in the profession would agree that the Veterinary Surgeons Act is you know, woefully out of date. And as Christine mentioned there, it was put in place 60 years ago and the whole nature of veterinary practice has changed. But I think that some of the most important things that we need to address as well are the fact that there are an increasing number of people, households and pet owners who are struggling financially. And as you mentioned there, the increase in costs is really affecting people. It's making people put off treatment, delaying treatment. Pets are getting sicker. And as a charity, we're seeing the sharp end of this with, you know, an increase in pets being relinquished and people, you know, visiting our food banks and accessing our hospitals because they can't afford treatment in private practice. So, you know, we absolutely welcome the review of the Veterinary Surgeons Act, but we also want to see more done to improve access to affordable vet care as well.
And, you know, this has got to a point, I suppose there's two things going on where I mentioned people are really dreading going to the surgery and therefore might not be getting, or perhaps they're doing what you're saying as well about trying to find a way to pay for this, but might not be getting help for their animals when they need it because of costs and fears of costs. But at the same time, Paul, there is, I suppose, a big change is also about the quality of life, the expectation, prolonging of life around animals. What do you have to say around that? Because it's a very fertile area, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I've been a vet for a couple of decades now, and the whole, you know, face of veterinary medicine has changed whilst I've been practicing. You know, expectations are higher from clients. We see lots of shiny TV shows with all these really advanced procedures, but these do come at a cost. And I think it's really important that vets and pet owners address affordability and are really able to take a welfare focused approach to their pets. Quality of life is incredibly important, and just because a treatment is available doesn't mean it's the right thing for that pet, and certainly not if a client can't afford it and they're going to get themselves into huge amounts of debts, which we're hearing every day.
Christine, just picking up on that, I mean, is there a limit around, I mean, each animal's different, of course, and their life and their sort of context of their life, but are there limits to how long one should try and prolong the lifespan of animals? And I know this is a delicate thing, but you sort of know what I'm asking and why.
Yes. So I'm with Paul, and he mentioned about it's all about quality of life for me, being comfortable and content. And there's a real role for the veterinary surgeon, the vet nurse and colleagues to help the owners through that process and through that journey. Choosing that it is the end time for your animal, it's a really, really difficult decision. But often when I was in practice, many pet owners to me, you know, when you go through the process, it's very gentle, comforting, and so on. And they recognise it was the right thing to do. So people shouldn't, that is always an option. People shouldn't feel bad about making a choice that it is the end for their animal. It's all about the quality of life in their circumstances.
And coming back to the quality of life of the vets, Christine, do you also hope these changes might improve that? Because there are workforce shortages, there are issues, even though there's this tension that has become and grown up between people thinking individual vets, which some of whom are extremely, you know, wealthy and getting these high fees and you know, really profiting from this experience. But there's a whole other reality as well, isn't there?
Absolutely. Many of these businesses now are not owned by vets. So vets work for a salary that is competitive in the market. But not everybody, all owners appreciate that. So I think the recognition that veterinary businesses will be regulated and there will be a complaints procedure around that, rather than everything being targeted at the individual vets, will be really important for vets and nurses and everybody working in the practice.
And Paul, on that point?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're seeing, you know, a lot of mental health issues in the profession, a lot of burnout, a lot of dropout. And, you know, it's a complex situation. But ultimately, a lot of vets are working for businesses. And the vet that you see in front of you when you take your pet to see a vet isn't the vet that sets the prices, isn't the vet that runs the business. And, you know, vets also have been calling for action to be taken and have supported a lot of the actions that have come out of the CMA review last year. So I think there's a lot of vets out there that really do want change. And you know, we all go into the profession for the same reason, to help animals and to protect their health and welfare. So when we, you know, are faced under fire for these financial, you know, conversations, it doesn't yes. sit right with us.
Paul, we're going to have to leave it there. Paul Manktolo, Christine Middlemiss, thank you.
Hello, I'm Greg Jenner, and good news, Your Dead to Me is back for a new series.
Here we go.
Yes, we'll explore Emperor Nero's notorious reign with Professor Mary Beard and Patton Oswalt.
I would not want my daughter having the remote control, let alone an empire.
We'll dissect the decadent life of Philippe Duc d'Orléans with Tom Allen.
I've often tried to pretend I'm an aristocrat and been very quickly knocked down.
And there'll be so much more with comedians like Olga Koch, Mike Wozniak and Ria Lena.
I'm excited.
Your Dead to Me, the comedy podcast that takes history seriously. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Now with the weather, here's Chris Fawkes.
Hi, Emma. Flooding continues to cause disruption today in the aftermath of Storm Chandra. There are over 100 flood warnings currently in force, the vast majority of these across southern counties of England. Now, weather-wise today, it is a better kind of day, with many areas having dry weather and spells of sunshine. But the leftovers of Chandra continue to bring outbreaks of rain to northeast Scotland. So wet for Aberdeenshire, wet for Orkney, with this rain gradually pushing into Shetland as the day goes by. There are plenty of showers further west in the Hebrides and the Highlands, these two moving northwards with time, and then the weather improves in Scotland with sunny spells becoming quite widespread. Now for Northern Ireland, England and Wales, many areas will be dry with spells of sunshine after a cold, frosty and locally icy start to the day. Now there are going to be some further showers coming into southern counties of England and the south of Wales, but these showers won't make the flooding any worse. Now temperatures today will reach around 7 to 9 Celsius pretty widely. Looking at the weather over the next few days, we do have another two batches of wet weather to come into southwest England, both systems Thursday and Friday bringing 10 to 20 millimetres of rain, and that could cause some further flooding problems. And at the same time, we'll see rain probably turning to snow up over the hills in the Pennines and the southern uplands as we head into the early part of Friday morning, bringing some tricky travelling conditions here. That's the latest.
Chris, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 28th of January. The headlines. Sir Keir Starmer is on his way to China to rebuild relations and trade, despite concerns about whether Beijing can be trusted. A leading technology boss has said AI will change everything, but there could be carnage along the way if the AI bubble bursts. And the first woman to be Archbishop of Canterbury will be confirmed in the role in just a moment of history for the church.
Also coming up in the next hour, can Labour hold on to power in Wales? I'll be talking to the First Minister, the leader of Welsh Labour, Eluned Morgan, at 8.30. Could the signs of Terry Pratchett's dementia have been spotted years earlier in his writing? And if so, could it lead to earlier diagnosis from people's changing use of vocabulary? And we'll hear it for non-fiction in our recommendations for children's books. The news read this morning by Lisa Costello.
Sir Keir Starmer is expected to arrive in China shortly to start the first visit to the country by a British Prime Minister since Theresa May in 2018. Sir Keir, who will meet President Xi tomorrow, argues previous governments have blown hot and cold in their approach to Beijing and that a consistent relationship is vital. The government was criticised for approving a new Chinese embassy in London despite security concerns about its location, and the Conservatives say Sir Keir is kowtowing to China. Our political editor, Chris Mason, is travelling with the Prime Minister.
This trip marks the latest and most important moment in the government's attempt to deepen the UK's relationship with China. The Chancellor, the Deputy Prime Minister and the Business Secretary have all been already. Now it's the Prime Minister's turn. He's expressed his frustration at what he sees as a dereliction of duty from recent Conservative governments in shutting out Beijing. He points out the Canadian Prime Minister and French President have both been recently, and says the UK had become an outlier in its outlook on China among comparable Western economies. Dozens of British outfits, corporate and cultural, are represented on this trip, including Barclays, Jaguar Land Rover and the Royal Shakespeare Company. Sir Keir Starmer's argument is China is one of the world's biggest economic players, so a strategic and consistent relationship is in the UK's national interest. And he insists engaging with Beijing allows issues such as human rights abuses to be raised with them. But the Conservatives counter that with the recent approval of a new Chinese mega-embassy in central London, Sir Keir's approach amounts to what they call surrender, when China, as they put it, poses a serious threat to our national security.
The chair of Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee, the Labour peer Lord Beamish, told us that the UK should engage with China while also protecting its interests.
China is the world's second largest economy. It's our third largest trading partner. Our report in 2023 was clear about the threat and security levels. And the conclusion is this: we've got to have a clear-eyed approach to China, but also be vigilant about the security threat that it poses.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry said the trip was a chance to open a new chapter in China-UK relations. Our correspondent in Beijing, Laura Bicker, considers how the visit is being viewed there.
China believes the UK is too close to the United States and simply follows Washington when it comes to foreign policy. So this visit for them is partly about the optics, about the prestige of showing images of a British Prime Minister, a key US ally, touring the Forbidden City and meeting Xi Jinping. The UK is not one of China's top trading partners, but officials still see London as an important financial heartland and will be keen to do a deal. China is using its status as the factory of the world to draw Western countries a little closer. It wants to be seen as a reliable partner as Donald Trump threatens trade tariffs. For Beijing, trade is the key to gaining global standing and influence as it plays the long game in its great power competition with Washington.
President Trump says his administration is going to, in his words, de-escalate a little bit in Minneapolis. Tensions are high in the city following the deaths of two protesters, Renee Good and Alex Pretty, at the hands of federal agents. Our correspondent Tom Bateman reports from Minneapolis.
When Donald Trump was asked about the killing of Alex Pretty, he said he certainly shouldn't have been carrying a gun. The comments will alarm those calling for an independent investigation into his death. Mr. Trump said the death of Mr. Pretty was a very unfortunate incident, but he has at the same time veered into commenting on the political views of the two dead Americans or their families, without explaining why this would have any bearing on the issue of their killings at the hands of federal agents. He said of 37-year-old Renee Good, her parents were big Trump fans, but that she had become, in the president's view, radicalised.
One of the world's leading technology bosses has warned that AI share prices are probably a bubble and that there will be carnage if it bursts. The chief executive of Cisco, Chuck Robbins, has told the BBC that while some companies won't survive, artificial intelligence will be bigger than the internet. He's been speaking to our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
Cisco is one of the world's leading technology companies behind some of the critical IT infrastructure enabling the day-to-day use of AI. It was hit when the original dot-com bubble burst in 2000, but survived and thrived after losing 80% of its value. Now its boss, Chuck Robbins, a confidant of President Trump, says while AI technology is unstoppable, there may be some financial turbulence ahead.
Every major technology revolution that we see feels like hype to begin with. And there's been a lot of discussion about, is this a bubble? And the answer is probably yes. There's carnage along the way, but it is going to be bigger than the internet.
Mr. Robin said some jobs were already being eliminated by AI, particularly in areas like customer services, where he said companies would need fewer people. But he urged people not to be afraid of the technology and embrace it in their lives.
The government is to offer AI training courses to every adult in the UK. The online courses will teach basic AI skills such as how to use artificial intelligence to create content and assist with admin. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleiman, reports.
Tech giants including Google and Microsoft have designed the AI skills training courses, some of which started rolling out last summer. There are about 600 different courses of varying lengths. Some take several hours, others just 20 minutes. Not all are free. 14 of those which don't cost anything are industry benchmarked. The government aims to reach 10 million workers by 2030, claiming this is the most ambitious training scheme since the Open University was launched more than 50 years ago. But AI tech is evolving rapidly, so these courses could date quite quickly.
The government is launching an 8-week consultation on its plans to make vet prices clearer and to clearly set out a complaints process for owners. These changes, the first for 60 years, come after hundreds of pet owners contacted the BBC to share their frustrations about rising costs. The UK's chief veterinary officer, Dr. Christine Middlemiss, told this programme that she welcomed elements of the proposals.
Recognition of the vet nurse title and the work that they do, recognition of other allied professionals we work with, equine dentists, cattle foot trimmers. The intention is that they would be regulated as part of the vet-led team. So a much broader regulation for all those under in the vet team that are providing healthcare.
The first woman to be Archbishop of Canterbury will be confirmed in the post at St Paul's Cathedral this morning. The ceremony marks the official start of Dame Sarah Mullally's tenure. Here's our religion editor, Ali Makbul.
The ceremony will be part religious service and part legal process. During it, Dame Sarah Mullally, for the last 7 years the Bishop of London, but previously Chief Nursing Officer for England, will be confirmed as the 106th Archbishop of Canterbury. She says she'll lead the Church of England with calmness, consistency and compassion, but has huge issues waiting for her to deal with, not least working with those in the Church at home and in the global Anglican Communion who vehemently believe women shouldn't be priests at all, never mind leading them. Given that her predecessor resigned after accusations he didn't do enough with information he had about a prolific abuser, there's already been intense scrutiny of Dame Sarah's record on safeguarding. The church is defending that, but some victim advocates feel there are still questions to answer.
The National Trust has carried out what it's called the ultimate recycling project by sinking three old barges in an estuary in Essex to protect the habitats of seabirds. The barges, which once transported coal and goods along the River Thames, have now been positioned to try to protect the salt marshes from erosion. Here's our environment correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
The National Trust says without intervention, the salt marsh off Northey Island in the Blackwater estuary will disappear within 100 years. The area is important for wildlife, including wading birds such as the redshank, dunlin and curlew. So the National Trust is trialling a novel solution by sinking three rusty old Thames barges at the edge of the salt marsh. It's hoping to slow down the sea's tidal flow that's steadily eating away at the salt marsh, while also creating a new island for the birds.
Jonah Fisher reporting.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. In about an hour's time, the Prime Minister's visit to China will get underway. His plane will touch down. There'll be a guard of honour and a speech to a business delegation. The meeting with Xi Jinping is due tomorrow. What is the point of that meeting? Keir Starmer says, like it or not, China matters to the UK. It matters because it's a huge economy and we must engage with it. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says no, China is no ordinary trading partner, she argues. We should not be relying on an authoritarian power that doesn't share our values for trade. This, of course, in the wake of the revelations about the way in which China spies on us, on the continuing imprisonment of an elderly British citizen, Jimmy Lai, who was merely exercising the rights that Hong Kong people were meant to have for 50 years in an agreement essentially torn up by the Chinese side. Let's start with our political editor, Chris Mason. He sent us this from the Prime Minister's plane as he and a delegation of business people travel to China overnight.
Hello to you from the Prime Minister's plane. As I send you this voice note, I think where are we? Somewhere over the Black Sea. And as you listen to this, we'll probably be a few hours shy of getting to Beijing. We're on a BA charter flight. Now, usually on these trips with the Prime Minister, it's him and his team and then a ragtag bunch of reporters like me. And that's pretty much it. A little different on this trip because dotted around us here in the cheaper seats, and indeed tantalisingly, some of them are through that curtain there in the posh bit, are a whole range of British businesses and cultural organisations and sporting bodies. Yes, there's the kind of big corporate names, but also folk like Table Tennis England and the National Museums Liverpool, among others. Now, this delegation is both a personification of what the Prime Minister wants this trip to be remembered for, which is deepening and widening cultural and economic ties with China. And it is also something of a shield against the moniker that really irritates him, the never hear Kia label, that idea that he's forever gallivanting around the world and doesn't spend enough time at home. What he'll try to do in the next couple of days is make an argument that the international and the national are indivisible. Now, Prime Minister told me on the way here when he popped to the back of the plane for a chat with reporters that China's the second biggest economy in the world and having a comprehensive and consistent approach to Beijing, as he put it, is pragmatic and is sensible. But the recurring questions, what about human rights and what about security? And to give you a sense on the security question, the government team here are all on disposable burner phone numbers and temporary email addresses, iPads and earbuds, usable tech, pretty much out, left at home under the bed, and it's kind of notepads and pens and then kit that they might not bring back. Such is the anxiety about security, about bugging, about spying. And that is therefore the central conundrum, the central challenge. China, this growing economic powerhouse, but a powerhouse of a wildly different worldview. How do you handle that?
Let us hear directly, though, now from one of the business leaders on that trip. We will hear from the Chinese government in a second, or at least from someone who knows the thinking of the Chinese government. Let's talk to one of those business people, or at least hear from him. Will Butler Adams is the CEO of Brompton Bikes, and we talked to him before he left for China.
I think what's exciting about this trip is, in some respects, to bring awareness to the opportunities that there are in China. We started with three of us having a cup of tea and opening a little store to experiment. And now China is our biggest market in the world. We've got nearly 35, 40 staff in China. I've learned great things about the culture. I've had amazing food. And there's great business to be done. So, and I think sometimes our perspective from the UK is not a real perspective. And we have politicians who talk about China or any other part of the world, but they've never really been there. They haven't spent time there. They don't really understand the people, the culture, and the opportunity. So I'm sort of there to encourage the engagement by our politicians to better understand the opportunity. We are facing some pretty big challenges on planet Earth. They're not going to be solved by the UK sorting it out. Global warming is not a UK problem. It's a global problem. How people live, how we rethink cities to be cleaner, more efficient. It's a global challenge. And so for us, there are 1.2 billion people in China. So engaging with those communities, engaging for us in particular with cities and trying to encourage them to get out of their car, their 2.5-ton metal box and get onto bikes is just as relevant there as it is in the UK, Europe or North America.
That was Will Butler Adams, the CEO of Brompton Bikes. He is on this trip. Let us hear then the view from China, as it were. I've been talking to Dr. Henry Wang, who's the founder and president of the Center for China and Globalization. He's a former councillor of the China State Council. We started with what China might gain from this visit.
Well, I think this visit is very significant, and it marked 8 years of isolation, and I see a phrase of Sino-UK relation entering a new phrase of development. A lot of things happened to push to this because we had a huge transformation in the global scene. We see multilateralism is under extreme stress, and we see the world is divided. And so it's no longer China versus the West or West versus China now. I think, as Prime Minister Starmer said, we're not forced to pick a side between U.S. and China. So that's great direction to have. So I think China, as usual, is always promote multilateralism, also promote against the unipolar world and safeguard free trade, and also for the climate change to maintain the clean world. So all those things, I think, are in line with what UK so many years has been defending and wanting. So I think we share a lot of a common interest. It's high time that both country leaders get together and go over those issues and build up a new consensus. You know, I'm not sure we were going back to the golden era, but at least we maintain normal relations rather than those agonizing relations in the past. So I think this visit is important for UK, and also it's good for China too, as we see business will be on the rising. Starmer brought 50-some business leaders to come, and I'm sure we're going to see more cooperation in the trade, in the finance, in the green technology, in the education, healthcare, tourism, and many more. So those are really a great time that we all meet again. But also, to tell the truth, we already, in the last 2 months, we had already four of the G7 leaders come, and next month we're going to have a MERS coming. So this is already a MAC trend. That everybody's no longer based on the Western party line now. It's based on their own merits and choose the right approach with China.
And if Keir Starmer wants to bring up difficult issues like the imprisoning of the British citizen Jimmy Lai, what notice will the Chinese side take of him, do you think, if any?
No, I think that is already a past tense, because Hong Kong, you know, a chaotic situation, unrest, 6 years ago is already caused a lot of problem for Hong Kong. But now it's really back to normal, and Hong Kong stock market is all recovered and it's doing very well, and all the business are returned. So I think we should not obsess with the past. Let's look forward to the future. And
It's not the past. It's not seen as the past in Britain, because Mr. Lai is a British citizen. There was an agreement.
Well, he has a Hong Kong
which was
idea
due
as
to
well.
Last until 2047. And because of that, there is a feeling in Britain that he should not be in prison.
He is also a Chinese citizen. He's a Hong Kong citizen, whatever. You know, I think they're going to subject to the Chinese laws and regulations, whatever. But what I'm saying is basically, you know, China-UK relations are so important, and we have so much big things going on, big pictures. We should really, you know, maximize the common interest and minimize the differences. That's really the attitudes I think we should have. I'm glad that Starmer is doing some of that, like approving the establishment of the new embassy relocation, and China is helping on renovating the UK embassy in Beijing too. So I think, you know, we're going to find a lot of common interests, particularly for the world that waiting for the new relation, new anchors, new leadership. I think UK and China can do many things in AI, in climate,
when you say that,
multilateralism.
When you say that, the leader of the opposition, the Conservative opposition in Britain, says this morning in an article in a newspaper that we shouldn't be reliant on, and I'm quoting her now, trade with authoritarian states that do not share our values. In other words, that there are dangers for Britain in this relationship with China.
That's the nonsense should be gone, because you see French president come, you see Canadian prime minister come, you see Finnish president still in China, you're going to see Merz come. So that's what I'm saying. The Western countries abandon this autocracy versus democracy narrative, this binary worldview. It's already, you know, it's past tense. We need to really have a multi-worldview, multipolar view, because, of course, every country has its advantage and disadvantage. Okay, but let's measure the performance. China is the second largest economy, and they contribute over 30% of global GDP growth, and also a largest trading partner with 150 countries. That's the fact. You know, lifted 800 million people out of poverty. I mean, whatever ideology or value you may have, you have to do your homework, make your domestic issue well before you criticize others. I think there's a lot of problem UK has, but let's constrain from pointing finger at the others and maximize the same interest and looking forward for the future cooperation, particularly for the world of this kind of turmoil. We need the UK and China to work together.
I suppose that the point is not so much that it's a clash of systems. I think people could understand that. I think the problem for some British politicians is that they're frightened that Britain will become dependent on trade with China, and that at some point in the future, for instance, if China were to threaten more against Taiwan or indeed to invade Taiwan, that there would be difficulties for those British companies, indeed those importers of Chinese goods, who would suddenly find that they weren't available, etc., etc.
I think it's very ironic, and, you know, you should criticize the US for invade Venezuela and kidnap their president. I mean, China is promoting peaceful communication with Taiwan, but of course not ruling out any extreme cases if Taiwan goes independence. But I think, you know, that's pretty clear. You know, the issue of Taiwan is a domestic issue. 184 countries established diplomatic ties with China, recognize there's only one China. So that's a bottom line. And China would love to see peaceful unification. But if there's a foreign intervention or there's independence that declared by Taiwan separatist, China would reserve the measures otherwise. So I think, you know, we should at this point in time that the U.S. is expanding to the Western Hemisphere and probably going to have a Western United States of a Western Hemisphere. You know, that's the danger we're facing now. You know, rather than just still focusing or you know, penalize China, you know, that's not really the right approach.
Henry Wang, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Well, listening to that at 22 minutes past eight, as Sir Keir Starmer prepares to touch down in China, the first UK Prime Minister to do so in 8 years since Theresa May, Liz Kendall, Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you trust Xi Jinping?
I think we're pretty clear-eyed about our relationship with China. We have made very clear that our national security always comes first, and that on all previous visits, and I'm sure today, we will raise issues around human rights abuses, and that is right. But we also want to deliver for our national interest in terms of the economy, and understand that it's a really important market for us.
Yes, of course.
The second largest economy.
On the question, we're well aware of the size of the economy. We've been analysing it all morning.
But that's an important point about our approach. And I think...
But do you trust Xi Jinping? Are you going in with a position of, we trust the leader of this country?
Well, we understand the national security issues, but we also know that on key areas, on the economy and on science, as you've said, where we're firm about our principles and values, but where we can work together, whether it's on climate change, global health, or on the economy, and we can have those good, strong partnerships based on our values, absolutely clear about our red lines, then we should work with China. In my own department on the science issue, our science minister, Patrick Vallance, went to China last year, was very clear about our principles and values on academic freedom, on intellectual property, on the use of data. But where we can guardrails,
yes,
we will work with them for the benefit of this country.
How about hacking the phones of senior officials in Downing Street? You're the tech secretary.
Mm-hmm. Look, you will understand why I can't comment on national security issues. I think that happened under the last government, but we are confident.
It could still be happening
we
now.
Are confident that all of the proper measures and safety is in place throughout Number 10 and from the Prime Minister. But the question
this is just because this is your area. I know you're not responsible for the technology of Downing Street, but you are responsible for technology in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say that no one's being hacked or tapped right now in Downing Street by China, the country that the Prime Minister is about to touch down in?
My understanding is that is all the security measures are in place, and that is safe for people throughout Downing Street, including the Prime Minister. What we are getting
to
here... It's
not a great look just before it, though, is it?
Well, this was under the last government, and you'll forgive me for not going through the detail of this. But at the heart of what you're getting to here, Emma, is what is the relationship... Can we have it based on trust? Can it work for the issues where
yes,
we believe there are potential advantages for the UK in terms of trade, business relationships, but I would also argue on science and research? And can we also be absolutely firm on the issues of human rights, of national security, and all the other values that we strongly believe in as the country? And we are clear-eyed about that. And this is hard-headed diplomacy here in Britain's interest. And I think that is the right approach to protect our country, but also work with China where there are those safe guardrails in place for the benefit of the country.
You're speaking as if we're an equal to China. And yet, how it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, the trip only was given the green light and all signed off after the government gave the go-ahead to the new China super embassy in London.
I actually think we are world leading in areas, particularly around science
no,
and
no,
technology.
No, you're going back to science and technology. I understand it's your beat, but
I asked you about the equality and the specifics of a Chinese embassy on the equality issue. I'm saying we're world leading in some of these areas. That is the issue of equality.
But you brought up hard-headed diplomacy.
Yes, and I've told you where I believe that we have world leading companies. You said, "Are we an unequal partner?" And I've answered,
but in a different context. It was a very different context. It was about how we're going into this relationship and how we're going into this meeting. You can go back to what we were saying before, but let me update the question again. The trip, is it true? The trip only went ahead after the government gave the go-ahead to the new China super embassy in London.
This has been a long time in the planning here. And on the embassy question, I think it is right that countries have embassies in our capital cities. The site was initially agreed, my understanding is, under Boris Johnson. Our security services have written publicly to say all of the security issues there are managed, and they indeed think that bringing it together onto one site will make those national security issues easier than having it on seven different sites. But we're going in focused on Britain's national interest here. We're under no illusions about the power of China's economy, but our focus is on delivering for Britain. I do believe we are leading the world in some areas, and there's more that we can do. And that's part of what I'm talking about today on winning the race on AI.
Well, AI, yes, perfect segue for me there. You're launching online AI training courses today. We look back at what our Christmas guest editor, the Microsoft AI boss, Mustafa Suleiman, told us. And he said, if you're not a little bit afraid at this moment, then you're not paying attention. Are you not worried by creating these courses in this way, some of which our technology editors looked at this morning and just linked to some of these big companies, aren't specific courses created solely by the government? Are you not worried that you're about to step into another mistake where, you know, like we did with social media, and now there's potentially a rowing back? You're not thinking through the potentially damaging consequences.
Look, I think I'm thinking through all the consequences. And it is precisely because I know that AI will bring disruption that we are saying, as a Labour government, we are not bystanders. We will not leave you to cope with these changes alone. Unlike former governments, we will help you through these changes. And I believe that giving free online courses for the entire population, all different types of courses that people can do 20 minutes to a whole day, that mums who are thinking about returning to work, small businesses can do it in their own time, is our clear way of saying that we will help you manage these changes. If we are going to get AI to work for Britain, we need Britons who can work with AI. Change is inevitable, but the consequences are not. And this is a huge upskilling program to give people the skills to put power and control in their hands so they can reap the benefits of AI and not just be left to cope with things on their own. This is a message about making the future work for people in this country, not just a few unaccountable people at the top of huge corporations. I think that is the right way forward.
Before our time runs out, Liz Kendall, you talk about people being left alone to cope. Should children under the age of 16 be banned from using social media? You are the technology secretary. Your view, not the explanation. The listeners know there is a consultation.
Yeah.
What is your view?
What's the point in having a consultation if I've already made up my mind?
But you may have a view and you are in a position of leadership.
I do, which is we need further action. We absolutely need further action because parents up and down the country are really worried about what's happening to their kids. They're worried about the impact on their mental health, on their sleep, on their concentration, on their anxiety, the addictive behaviour. And having met many bereaved families, they are deeply worried about what's happening right here, right now, and the access to terrible things that have led to appalling consequences. We have acted. We acted on Grok. We acted on Grok and X changed, and I'm very proud of that. We want to see the current law enforced, and we want to go further in future. We will act and set out our proposals before the summer, because this is something that families right across the country are worried about. I've listened to all of your really interesting discussions on the Today programme over recent weeks. Lots of different views about this, strongly held on both sides of the argument. The NSPCC, Ian Russell and others saying, look, a ban isn't the right way forward. You know, it leads to a cliff edge at 16.
Do you agree with those who say that?
If I'd made my mind up, what would be the point of a consultation here? We want to get this right. We want to act swiftly. And we know that there are other parents and actually teachers. I spent a day with teachers in my own constituency this week where they're very, very clear. They don't want phones in schools and they want a ban for social media for under 16s. The question is not whether we act, but what we do next. We're learning from Australia. But let me be very clear to your listeners. We want to give children their childhood back. We want to prepare them for the future because the online world will be part of their future. And above all, we are going to keep kids safe online.
Liz Kendall, Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology. Thank you.
28 minutes to nine to the sport. Here's Mike.
Justin, thank you. A blockbuster night of European football awaits us all. 18 matches in the Champions League kick off simultaneously at 8 p.m. this evening as the league phase of the competition draws to a close. All six English clubs are in action. Of them, only Arsenal have so far guaranteed a top eight finish, which brings direct progression to the last 16. So Chelsea, Liverpool, Manchester City, Newcastle and Tottenham all have something to play for later, as do a host of other European heavyweights. So let's try and look ahead to what will surely be a frenetic evening. We can cross live to Paris now and say bonjour to the Premier League winner Chris Sutton, who joins us live on the programme. Hi Chris.
Hello Mike.
You are in France, aren't you, for the holders, Paris Saint-Germain against Newcastle later, which, looking at the league table, is effectively a winner-takes-all clash, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly looks that way. The importance of avoiding those playoffs to big clubs, you know, all the Premier League clubs have, at this moment in time, seem to be or have injury concerns and what have you. So it is big this evening. Fascinating evening. And yeah, PSG against Newcastle, 6 against 7th. They're on the same amount of points, 13. Same with the goal difference as well. And you do feel that tonight it's a big ask for Eddie Howe's team to come to Paris and get the victory. But you never know.
Commentary of that on 5 Live. Looking at the other English sides, Manchester City, the only Premier League club who will start the evening outside the top eight, but Galatasaray at home will surely be enough for them, a victory there to get through to the last 16.
You would think so. I mean, I was in Boda last week when Manchester City slipped up. Actually, they were well beaten by a really well-organised Boda team. But, I think Manchester City, you know, not only do they need to win well because, the goal difference will come into it for them. So, yeah, it is. I mean, they've given themselves unnecessary work to do. And, you know, obviously them qualifying depends on the other results, which makes tonight really, really fascinating with all the games going on and kicking off simultaneously.
Of the other three English sides, Chelsea away to Italian champions Napoli, Tottenham face Eintracht Frankfurt in Germany, and Liverpool just need to beat Carabag at Anfield to reach the last 16. Of those three, of those matches, Chris, so which intrigues you the most?
The surprise package of this competition really has been Carabag, and you just never know what you're going to get from Liverpool this season. You know, they've been really inconsistent under Arne Slot. I think it's a big night for Tottenham and Thomas Frank, who seems to be under pressure. Premier League form isn't great. Champions League, they've been going fine. They're playing Eintracht Frankfurt, who haven't covered themselves in glory in the Champions League this season. So it is fascinating. Chelsea have got the work cut out against Napoli. That'll be a difficult tie for them, but Lim Rosinha started well as Chelsea manager. But yeah, it's a hard one to call this evening. What are there's six or seven sides on 13 points, and it'll be a really interesting evening.
It's going to be fascinating. You'll be across it all with commentary of Paris Saint-Germain against Newcastle live from Paris on 5 Live and BBC Sounds. You can hear Manchester City against Galatasaray as well over on 5 Sports Extra. It is an evening where the live league table is changing minute by minute. Not many teams sure of their own destiny. You can follow it all, as we say, on BBC Sounds from 8 p.m. this evening.
Mike, thanks very much. Looking ahead, just after 9, don't go anywhere because More or Less will be here. Here's Tim Harford.
It's the last episode in this series, and we've been looking for suitably epic topics. Let me know what you think of these. Are 1990s pop icons, Right Said Fred, right about what they said? Can I run on a treadmill in a funny mask? And is a sauna really 10 times as hot as Wales? We also have some grown-up stuff about the World Economic Order and the UK's welfare state, if you insist. That's More or Less, with me, Tim Harford, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. In half an hour.
To the weather, it's going to be mostly dry, patchy cloud and bright spells. The chance, though, of rain in the early morning. Well, the early morning's gone, hasn't it? Anyway, the late afternoon, at least for some.
I was going to say at least for some. We've seen too much of this morning already, but here you go. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb in Cardiff, Emma Barnett in London. It's 24 minutes to 9, and now a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
Sir Keir Starmer is due to arrive in China shortly for a three-day visit aimed at building a steady and strategic relationship with Beijing. Around 60 British business and cultural leaders are also on the trip. The Technology Secretary, Liz Kendall, told us Sir Keir would raise issues around human rights abuses, but that the UK would work with China for the benefit of this country. President Trump says his administration will, in his words, de-escalate a little bit in Minneapolis. Tensions remain high after two protesters were killed by federal immigration agents. One of the world's leading technology bosses has said the AI share price boom is probably a bubble and warned that some companies may not survive if it bursts. The chief executive of Cisco, Chuck Robbins, added that the technology itself would be bigger than the internet. The government is launching a consultation on plans to make prices clearer at vets practices. The watchdog, the Competition and Markets Authority, has found that vet prices have risen at nearly twice the rate of inflation.
Thank you for that. It is 22 minutes to 9. Can Labour hold on to power in Wales? If they don't in the Senate elections on May the 7th, it's not just a changing of the guard. It's going to feel to many Welsh people like an earthquake. Labour always wins here, always in the devolved parliament ever since it started, always in general elections too. So what is it going to take to win this time? Eleanor Morgan, the First Minister, the leader of Welsh Labour, is here in our Cardiff studio. Good morning to you.
Bore da.
You had yesterday a significant moment, didn't you, in your government, because you've managed to pass a budget. Why does that matter? What difference will it make?
Well, we've never had a majority in Wales, although we've been the biggest party. The fact is we've always had to negotiate. And yesterday, people wrote us off, said we'd never get our budget through, but we managed to do that. We focused a Labour values budget on the things that matter to the people of Wales, making sure that we do put more money into the health service. We've seen a 90% drop in our waiting lists since the pandemic. You know, things are heading in the right direction. And that's because we've now got a lot more money from the UK government. They're committed to public services in a way that the Tories never were. The taps have been switched on. And that is starting to make a difference. But it's taken a long time. We've had 14 years of austerity, but now we can focus that money on the issues that matter to the people of Wales.
Just on
the cost
service.
Of living crisis is something that people are very
concerned. And we'll get to that in a second, in your relationship with the government in Westminster as well. You said a 90% drop in waiting lists. Because when we were out talking to people yesterday, everyone brings it up and they don't seem to think it is improved. What actually, so for instance, for someone waiting, I don't know, a year, 2 years for something, are those waits now going to be a thing of the past and how soon?
So the average wait in Wales is 19 weeks. So that's a huge improvement already. At the end of the pandemic, we came out much more slowly from the pandemic and the people of Wales valued that and voted for it in the last election. But it did mean that those waiting lists went up higher.
But your case to the people of Wales is, look, the waiting lists
are going down. We have sorted this, or we're in the process of sorting
it. We are definitely in the process of sorting it. They're coming down quicker than they are in England. We're throwing everything at that, and it is making a difference.
And you made the case right at the start that you're able to do these things. You've got a good relationship with the government in Westminster, a Labour government, of course. I put it to you that actually you haven't. Because when you go to them and you mention specific things and you ask for them, and you did this recently with police reforms, where you want the kind of devolution of power that we're going to see, and also the single forces that we're going to see across England, you want that in Wales as well, and you want Wales police to be answerable to the Senedd. What the Home Secretary said in very plain terms is no. So you don't actually have the power with this government that you're suggesting to the Welsh people that you have.
Look, what we've got with this government is a third chapter ready to be written in the history of devolution. So the first chapter was about establishing the Senedd, and it only went through on a whisker. We had to establish that. It was a time of plenty. We had saw budgets going up by 10% a year.
They're not willing to give you the things
you're asking. We've had 14 years of austerity since then, and now the taps are being turned on. This is an opportunity.
They're not being turned on, for instance, with police reform. You made a specific request, and the Home Secretary has said no. And that, it seems, is the end of the matter, isn't it?
Look, I'm focused on the areas where I have control and the ability to make a difference in Wales. That's why that budget was significant. And that's why.
But those are the areas you already have control. When it comes to adding to devolution, which is the case that you have made, I'm putting it to you that the Westminster government seems to show no interest in that at all. And the absence of a Welsh devolution of power when it comes to police is evidence of that, isn't it?
Look, I think what people in Wales are concerned with is the bread and butter issues that matter in their daily lives.
But I asked you again about police, and you're not answering about it. It's just on police. Is that now a dead issue? You've asked for something and they've not given it to you, and that's it.
We've been consistent in our ask in relation to policing, not under the Labour government, but prior to that under the Tory government. Our position remains
consistent. You're not getting
consistent.
It under either, are you?
Welsh Labour values, and Welsh Labour is distinct from UK Labour, remain consistent, and we've been consistent when it comes to requests for policing. But I think in May, what people are interested in is looking to the future, that next chapter where we will be growing the economy of Wales. We've just landed £16 billion of investment, and what we want is job creation. I want to take this country out of poverty and make sure that we open that new chapter with that those taps turned on. Made a difference
really
already.
Talking to people in Wales, which we're doing yesterday, a lot of voters who are interested in these elections, making a distinction between Keir Starmer and his government and yours, but a lot also saying that they could not make that distinction. Are you saying to the people of Wales that Keir Starmer is a good Prime Minister?
What I'm saying to the people of Wales is...
Are you saying that he's a good Prime Minister?
What I'm saying to the people of Wales is that he's not on the ballot paper. That is not what people will be voting for in May.
So you're not able to say to them Keir Starmer is a good Prime Minister?
I am absolutely clear that who is on the ballot paper in May is not Keir Starmer. This is not an election. This is not an opportunity for a free hit against the UK government. This is not a time for protest votes. The things that matter here is who is going to deliver those services that people rely on in Wales. And the fact is that people will have a choice. They'll have a choice between the chaos that reform will offer, the pipe dreams that Plaid will offer, which will be a road to independence. Even the leader of Plaid Cymru has said that that's what he's interested in.
No, he was here an hour ago saying he wasn't at all interested, certainly not in the first term
But every decision will be made within that context.
But he thinks can have open arguments. So you can't say whether Keir Starmer is a good Prime Minister. I imagine he would be able to say, no, I think on these terms and these terms, he's not a good Prime Minister. And with that openness of argument, you can have a proper discussion about what Wales gets, to put it bluntly. Not able to have that. That's the point.
Hang on, what you're suggesting is that because he's able to shout louder, he'll get more. I just don't think that's a tenable situation. That is what his argument is. The fact is that already, because of the fact that I'm able to pick up the phone to Keir Starmer. We have seen a huge shift in terms of support for Wales.
But you think he's a good Prime Minister and he doesn't take any notice.
We've seen the development, for example, of the first small nuclear reactor in Wales, right in the constituency of the leader of Plaid Cymru. There was no acknowledgement of that in your earlier interview. No acknowledgement of the fact that there's going to be two AI growth zones. No acknowledgement of the fact that we've had the biggest uplift in the history of devolution when it comes to money to support those public services that people rely on. And that's what worries me, is that people have learnt to rely on things in Wales. Those free bus passes for the elderly. We're making an offer in May, if we come back, that there will be a bus fare cap in Wales of £2. And just last weekend, we've been clear that in keeping with the values that we're interested in, we will be paying school support staff throughout the year, not just during term times. These are labour values that have made a difference. Things that people in Wales, like free prescriptions, they're taken for granted. They don't realise that's not available in England. These are political choices. We have made those political choices. Other parties will make different choices, and those services they've been relying on may not be there in future after May. But what I'm interested in is a positive offer.
Thank you very much for talking to us in our Cardiff studio this morning. Ellen Morgan, First Minister and leader of Welsh Labour.
It's 14 minutes to nine. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has revealed that more people have arrived in the UK than have been returned under the one-in, one-out pilot scheme. Downing Street has insisted that the number of migrants under a returns deal with France, you may remember the details of that, will fluctuate. But just to be clear, at the moment, more people have arrived in the UK than have been returned. Danny Shaw is a former BBC Home Affairs correspondent and advisor to Yvette Cooper, former advisor, I should say, when she was Home Secretary. Danny, what do you make of this?
Hi, Emma. I mean, this is very embarrassing for the government. The numbers are still small. So around 281 have been returned to France under the deal and 350 have been admitted to the UK. So you're talking small numbers, but... And we knew that the scheme was meant to roughly balance so that the numbers coming in and going out would be broadly the same. But to have this differential of around 70 people, I think, shows the flaws in the scheme. And but I think what's more significant, Emma, is the fact that the numbers are still so low. I mean, even if they were in balance and 350 had gone back to France, that's still, you know, 5 to 6 months in. Those numbers are too low to have any deterrent effect on stopping people from getting into those boats to make the journey to the UK. I understand that the scheme's a pilot and that the numbers were going to be small in the beginning as the operational details were worked out. But by now, I would have expected the numbers to be significantly ramped up, and they're not. And unless they are, I don't think it's going to work as a deterrent.
Just to bring in at this point, because it does echo a little of what you were saying there, interestingly, the Home Office has pointed us to the Home Secretary's comments yesterday on this story, that there are very normal discrepancies in these numbers. She says they are still relatively small numbers, but the thing I would say is this was a pilot. It was designed to try to prove that this new model of working with the French could work. And there are practical issues around how quickly you can detain people and then get them on a plane and move them out to France. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's all absolutely correct. And it was a real achievement to get the deal in place. You know, that was something that the previous government had failed to do. And it may make a difference in the margins, certainly. There may be some people who decide that they don't want to take the risk. But when you have around 10,000 people having crossed since the deal was in place, and only, you know, less than 300 having been removed, anyone who's getting into a boat will decide to take that chance. So what we've got to see now is a real ramping up of this deal with the French. The UK has been paying the French government about £150 million a year over the last few years for extra border security, surveillance, drones, a detention centre and so on. I think that deal is due to be renegotiated if those negotiations aren't already underway. As part of that, there should be an agreement to significantly increase the numbers that are sent back to France under this deal. Otherwise, I fear that it's not going to have the effect that it was designed for.
How long do you think they've got?
Well, I think there's got to be some tangible progress in reducing the number of small boat crossings by the end of the year. Shabana Mahmood, I think, has done the right thing so far, as did her predecessor, Yvette Cooper, putting the building blocks in place through greater cooperation with European allies, extra powers for immigration officers and so on. But what you need to see in particular, I think, is asylum hubs in other countries where people whose claims have been rejected by the UK can be returned. I think that will make a difference. I know that there have been discussions with countries in the Balkans, particularly Kosovo. We need to see some action on that. If the numbers are not significantly reduced by the end of this calendar year, then I'm afraid I think people will lose faith in the government's attempts to stop this problem.
Oh, we'll have to see what goes on, I suppose, with that. We'll follow it closely. Danny Shaw, thank you very much for your analysis.
9 minutes to nine is the time. A couple of programme notes, as it were. The first is that we are going to talk to the leaders of all the main parties in Wales during the course of the election campaign. We heard, of course, this morning from the First Minister and also from the leader of Plaid Cymru. Plenty more of that to come in subsequent programmes. Also, we've talked a lot, haven't we, about social media and the under-16s, the rights and wrongs of a ban, etc., etc. On Friday's programme, we want to look in more detail at how it all plays out in the home. So how do parents handle their families' use of social media and screen time more generally? We had a fascinating conversation the other morning, didn't we, with the parents of children who had themselves appeared on the programme about how they deal with the rules and indeed break the rules that they set. So do get in touch with us. How do you approach it? What are the conversations you have with your children? What are the limits or rules that you set around media, social media screens and phones? And do you indeed follow those rules yourself? It's the WhatsApp 0330 1234 346, or you can just email us today at bbc.co.uk. Now, can dementia be spotted earlier through a change in vocabulary? Researchers claim to have picked up just such a change in the works of the late Terry Pratchett. Here he is, speaking to the BBC in 2013 about his condition.
I don't like the disease. I wish I could read. Something about what I've got, I can't skim read as I always used to. You know, you go right down there and that's it, you've got it all. And now I'd have to go almost like a kid going through the words and syllables and sorting it out. That's gone. And I don't like it, because now I can talk to my computer and, you know, use it quite well. I can write.
That was Terry Pratchett. Let's talk to Dr. Tom Wilcoxon, who is a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Loughborough and led this research project. Morning to you.
Good morning.
What is it that you think you might have discovered?
We've discovered an early diagnostic marker potentially for cognitive decline and dementias. Often with dementia, people might notice that they have it once they have a memory impairment. But that memory impairment might happen already when the poisonous proteins that are involved in dementia have already damaged the brain. But there might be early symptoms of dementia that are found earlier in the disease pathway. And that's what our research looks at. So one of those things that we think we've found then is that language deteriorates maybe as much as 10 years before these memory impairments might start affecting the brain.
So if that is the case, you could genuinely pick things up from what? From the use of language in daily life or things that people wrote or what?
Yes, that's what we're interested in looking into next. So what we have found at the moment is that Terry Pratchett's pool of adjectives changed after his and before his diagnosis, maybe 10 years before his diagnosis. Now, we would like to take that knowledge and use it as a diagnostic marker for the general population. Obviously, people on the street don't have as many published novels as Terry Pratchett. So what we would like to do instead is maybe look at people's emails or WhatsApp messages or their Facebook posts and look at their use of language as well and see if we can spot these early signs that there might be cognitive decline at play. So we could use language then as an early diagnostic marker.
Dr. Tom Wilcoxon from Loughborough University, thank you.
Well, 5 minutes to nine, just time to talk about reading and your habits. We've only had 28 days of 2026. How is the reading going in your house? Any better? I ask because the Department for Education has declared it a national year of reading in a bid to boost literacy and engagement with books. Now, we have had several discussions inspired by this initiative on the programme, with author after author coming on to recommend their favourite books. But the Children's Laureate of Wales, Nicola Davis, noticed that all the recommendations, I believe, were fiction. Where's the non-fiction? She wrote into us about this, and now she's here with us, or on the line, I should say. Nicola Davis, Welsh Children's Laureate. Good morning.
Hello. Lovely to speak to you.
Very good to talk to you. And in a moment, we'll hear from Adam Kay, former doctor and now author, as well as a BAFTA-winning screenwriter. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
But first to you, Nicola. Why did you get in touch? Tell us what you're saying about non-fiction.
I think parents tend to focus on reading fiction to their kids. And there are lots of reasons for reading nonfiction. I think parents think that nonfiction is boring. They associate it with textbooks. But we're living in an absolute golden age of nonfiction for kids. All sorts of voices, fantastic illustration, beautiful design, lots of different approaches, carefully curated to communicate with audiences of particular ages. I think children's motivation to read is really important, and curiosity, finding out about the world, is one of the biggest motivations that there is. And if you look at the research, actually little kids want to read non-fiction rather than stories. And I think for parents, it takes the pressure off a bit too. You don't have to perform, you don't have to find 15 different voices for all the characters in a book. Reading nonfiction with your kids is a voyage of discovery that you both go on, and it opens conversations that encourage children's questioning and curiosity and builds their ability to explore the world and distinguish what's real from what's fake.
It's funny, isn't it, Adam, with your experience of writing of both, you know, what would you say to that, and how we often think when we start children on the path of reading that it should just be sort of stories?
Well, I hear from a lot of parents and getting letters, emails, messages on social media saying that they thought their kids didn't like books. They were reluctant readers, as they're often called. And then they read one of my books. And this is the best possible message against an author. And suddenly they enjoyed it. And it wasn't that they didn't like books. It's that they hadn't found the right books. And so this is, you know, nonfiction offers something that's often bite-sized, dip-in, dip-outable for kids who aren't able to, you know, manage full chapter books or don't enjoy that so much. For kids who love facts, Nicola says, the kids who love very visual illustrated books, the kids who want to, you know, inform their parents of all these exciting things they've learned. And I would say I've also heard from a lot of parents of neurodiverse kids saying, in particular, this sort of book that's opened up reading for them.
That's very interesting in itself. And I suppose when we think of, you know, our favourite books going back and perhaps into our own childhoods, you know, that'll be interesting if that changes what we recommend. Did you have non-fiction, Adam, that you were reading when you were growing up that springs to mind? I'm sure you were reading the Encyclopedia.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I love the big Dorling Kindersley illustrated book that would tell me what it's like inside a ship, inside the body, inside. And I was fascinated by that. And I think that's informed what I do with my books. You know, I don't think I had anything quite like mine, which sort of went for the, I mean, tried to get kids hooked by being funny, by being a bit subversive, by being a bit gross out. You know, when you're talking about the body, you can easily do all the various fluids. But yeah, I loved nonfiction and I still do.
Nicola, did you have a recommendation?
Oh, well, my first reading experience with nonfiction was actually my father's encyclopedias, the wonderful cellophane illustrations of the inside of a human body.